economic development, energy security policy, and renewable energy, and also through that to national security. So I think we're very lucky today to have an eminent group of speakers and panelists that will help us try to envision what would it mean if national climate legislation were passed for our country and our state. And we're not here to explore whether climate change is occurring or not, and at what rate, and what the impacts would be, because there have been numerous venues at which those issues have been discussed. Instead, we're going to tightly focus on the opportunities and challenges that would occur nationally and within Nebraska if climate change legislation were to be passed. So to help us start off today's forum, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, but before I do that, I'd like to say that the symposium today was an idea that came out of a group of us with sponsorship from three entities. One is the University of Nebraska Public Policy Center as part of its annual policy seminar series, which is supported with funding from the UNL College of Arts and Sciences Thomas C. Sorensen Endowment. It's also supported by the Nebraska Center for Energy Sciences Research, which has at its root funding from the Nebraska Public Power District. And finally, we have support from the National Resources Defense Council. So with that, I would like to then invite our first speaker, President James Milliken, who leads our University of Nebraska system. And President Milliken will talk to us about the themes of the conference. President Milliken.
Thanks, Ken. When I asked for a brief introduction, I didn't realize how agreeable you were going to be. Good afternoon. Thanks to everybody for being here today for this discussion of climate change, energy policy, and economic opportunity. It's clearly one of the most important subjects affecting people across the globe now and for generations to come. And if any more evidence is needed for that, I would rest my case on one point alone. Tom Friedman has written a new book about it. I'm pleased to not only journalists like Friedman are engaged in the issue, but also the best political and policy and financial minds in our country have turned their attention to this issue. You can't go to a leading conference, whether it's in Aspen or South Carolina or Europe now, of leading thinkers and policymakers without a serious discussion of climate change and energy policy for this country and for the world. Ken mentioned that the leaders, a few days ago, the presidential candidates in particular, both parties acknowledge the urgency of enacting climate change legislation. And I think most people predict that some important climate change legislation will certainly be debated and hopefully passed during this next Congress. But as some evidence of how timely this conference is, how well-timed it was, we now know today what we could not have known 2 days ago. And that is, we know what the next president's plan is for climate change and for energy investments in this country. President-elect Obama has proposed an economy-wide cap and trade program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 80% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. And his energy and environment plan outlines a strategy for creating over 5 million new green jobs. Well, the potential for climate change legislation opens new opportunities for our country and certainly for Nebraska, as well as our public university. I hope you all had a chance to read David Hawkins' piece in the World Herald this week, which lays out pretty clearly in dollars and in jobs, what the impact can be for the state of Nebraska with its abundant resources, including wind. I asked David a few minutes ago where Nebraska ranked in wind resources in the country, because I'd forgotten what his piece said. He told me sixth, and today I would argue that point. I think if we were taking advantage of it, we might be number one. I hope that every politician and policymaker in Nebraska will read David's piece, and I will do my part to help them to make sure it's in front of them so that we can all have a shared understanding of what the possibilities are for our state if we take advantage in it. We're very interested, of course, in what this national legislation would mean to agriculture and business and renewable energy industries in Nebraska. But from my perspective, I'm also quite interested in what its implications would be for the University of Nebraska, where I think we can build on our strong record in research on drought mitigation, on alternative energy, and climate research to be a national leader. We also need to consider the educational programs to build on strengths in that area so that Nebraskans, including our graduates, can be active participants in this new economy that will be created and encouraged by national legislation. I think the University of Nebraska and our state are well positioned to take advantage of new legislation for the benefit of Nebraska. We can be a national laboratory for the study of climate. Our expertise in related areas have already made us a national leader for research, and I'm committed to continued investment in those areas. You know, earlier this year, you all know that the Nebraska legislature agreed to make land available to the university for a public-private research campus next door on 250 acres, and we now it's now apparent that the first occupant of this space will be a federal research facility focused in part on alternative energy. I think that the opportunities here for public, university, federal, and private sector investment in the Innovation Campus that will address issues which are built on strengths in our research at the University of Nebraska and built on issues that are important to the University of Nebraska in the state of Nebraska, this is a great platform for us, and this is, I think, really a great opportunity for us to think about how the Innovation Campus can benefit from building on strategies for alternative energy research, climate research, and economic activities. This is an exciting time for our country. It's an exciting time for the world, and this is a significant part of it. The University of Nebraska is delighted to serve as host for this conference. I join Ken in welcoming all of you. I look forward to the discussion today. I look forward to the opportunities presented to the state of Nebraska and the University of Nebraska by the important legislation that will be taken up in the next session. So thanks to all of you for being here. I hope you have a great conference.
Thank you very much, President Milliken. We're now going to move to the plenary presentations in our session today. The first to be given by David Dawkins, Director of the Climate Center in the National Natural Resource Defense Council. David joined the NRDC as an attorney in 1971 and worked on air pollution issues until 1977. He was then appointed an assistant administrator in EPA on air, noise, and radiation issues. He then, after a stint with EPA, returned to the NRDC, the Natural Resource Defense Council, and worked throughout the next decade primarily on reauthorizing the Clean Air Act. David was the director of the NRDC's Air and Energy Program from 1990 to 2001, until he became director of this newly created Climate Center in 2001. He's recognized as an expert on advanced coal technologies, carbon capture and storage, and is working with Congress to design legislation and legislative mechanisms to reduce global warming emissions. David has an English degree from Yale College and a law degree from Columbia University, and I suggest he's one of the few people I've met that really seems to have a helicopter view of all of the issues, all of the complexities, all of the opportunities that are embodied in
trying to design climate change legislation, and we hope that he'll share that helicopter view with us today. David, he'll speak to us on the fundamentals of climate change legislation.
Let's welcome him.
No, we don't know how to get my talk up. So while I'm thanking people, someone can figure that out.
Here we go.
First, thanks to President Milken for the great kickoff remarks and for to the university for making this forum possible. And thanks also to you, Ken, for the nice introduction. The Natural Resources Defense Council is quite a mouthful. We thought of calling ourselves N, but then we thought you guys might have something to say about that. So we're still the Natural Resources Defense Council, and we're going to look for getting the slideshow part up there.
Can we see? There. Where's the PowerPoint?
This
is the curse of Windows 2007.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Excellent. success. Now, after that, solving global warming should be easy. The challenge of doing something about global warming has been on some people's minds for a number of years. Indeed, in the late 1980s, the first serious conversations about this issue and requiring government policies began. We have wasted almost 20 years now. And unfortunately, I think that's an accurate description of the policy process. We've wasted time that we didn't that we now know for sure we didn't have the luxury of wasting. In 2007, with the 110th Congress, things began to change, and for the first time, we had. Scores of committee hearings on climate change legislation and a bill actually going to the Senate floor. That bill was not really debated. The first step in considering that bill was the insistence by the Senate Minority Leader, Senator McConnell, that the entire 400-page bill be read word by word. Which took about 8.5 hours of the Senate's time, so that's where your taxpayer dollars were going that day. About two-thirds of the way through the reading of that bill, a tornado touched down on Capitol Hill, and some commentators said maybe this was a message from Mother Nature that it was time to get on with things. The bill did not succeed in gaining a sufficient vote to proceed to a vote on the merits, so it was tucked away and the Senate went on with its business. Now that plus $4 gasoline and the financial meltdown has led some to consider, well, yeah, climate change needs to be addressed, but let's get first things first, and don't we need legislation to address the economy? And then don't we need legislation to make sure we don't have $4 gasoline again? And once we got those things straightened out, then maybe we can start to think about addressing this issue of global warming and try to fit that into the agenda. If there's one thing I want to, that I hope to persuade you to leave here with today, is that that's precisely wrong, that if we try to address these three issues of our economic challenges, our energy challenges, and the need to protect the climate as three separate issues, we will fail. We cannot have a sustainable economy that gets energy policy wrong. And we cannot have a sustainable energy policy that ignores the climate. Nor can we have a climate protection agenda that does not recognize the core objectives of a strong economy and a reliable, predictable, and affordable supply of energy. We have to look at these three things together. We cannot afford to have three teams going off into separate rooms or separate cabinet agencies and looking at this. What that says for the congressional agenda is that we cannot afford a process where congressional committees decide they're going to write an economic recovery bill that ignores the topics of energy and climate. And nor can we have a bill that is focused on energy that treats the climate as though it were an optional criterion. It isn't an optional criterion, and even though some members of Congress may not realize that yet, Mother Nature has a way of making her points clear over time. Unfortunately, with the issue of climate change, by the time that those points are made abundantly clear to every single person, we are pretty much sunk, because we will have a loading of the atmosphere with pollutants that will be around for 1,000 years or more. Carbon dioxide is a different pollutant than the conventional ones we're looking at. If you look at soot coming out of a smokestack, the moment you turn on pollution controls, the soot stops coming out of the smokestack, and it's out of the atmosphere within a matter of weeks. Carbon dioxide's a different creature. Half of the carbon dioxide that we put into the air fighting World War I is still in the air today. 1,000 years from today, the carbon dioxide that's put up today, 15% of it will still be in the atmosphere. So we have a legacy. I like to say that it's something like going to a movie theater and discovering that you're in to see a 10-hour movie and the doors are locked. Once we're in the box, we're in the box. And that means that we've got to anticipate it and not wait for the traditional approach to solving these problems. The traditional approach being, we wait until the evidence of what we're doing wrong is so clear that we decide to tweak the system and respond. If we use that method of approaching climate change, we will fail. So we need to get ahead of the curve. And we've got a great opportunity with a new Congress and a new president. And I agree completely with President Milken that the president-elect gets it. His policy that was articulated this summer on his energy and climate plan understands very much that there are opportunities here to build a strong economy, deliver secure energy, and protect the climate, and that we have to do these three things together. And the good news is that if we do these take these three challenges on together, we can provide enormous economic opportunities in that agenda. Again, President Milken mentioned Tom Friedman's new book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded. I would commend it to you. It's really a good read. With Friedman's usual style and enthusiasm, but there's a lot of substance behind it in terms of his description of how the 21st century big market opportunity is going to be in the area of smart and clean energy technologies. So to get to what the task at hand is, it's important to understand just how these pieces of legislation are going to get fit together. And I'm going to try to cover these 4 points, but spend most of the time on the last 2 points. The first one about global science being clear, I've talked about it a little bit. The overall architecture of a bill we think is one that needs to cover the entire economy through something called a cap and trade system, which I will talk to you about. And then the really important topic to discuss is the allegations of a conflict between our economic and our energy objectives and those of protecting the climate. I would argue that there is not a conflict, and indeed that we cannot secure the first two objectives of economic and energy security if we fail to protect the climate. And then finally, getting a little closer to home, what does the opportunity of comprehensive climate legislation for a state like Nebraska look like? And the answer is it's a green scenario in more ways than one. On the science, the scientific community across the world has been studying the climate issue in earnest for the last 20 years or so, and the most recent assessment of the thousands of articles in the literature was published in 2007 by something called the Intergovernmental Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which IPCC, which was awarded a Nobel Prize for its contribution. A little personal anecdote, I served on a couple of the committees that helped produce this report, one of 2,000 people. And I got in the mail a few months after the Nobel announcement a nice certificate suitable for framing. It's still sitting on my cabinet. It hasn't been framed yet. But, you know, so I guess I'm the proud holder of 1/2,000th of a Nobel Prize acknowledgement without the money. But I was very happy to be a part of it. But the IPCC has nailed down the fundamentals of this. And interestingly enough, at the same time, a process has been going on in the United States called the Climate Science Research Program that is sponsored by this administration. And they have put out a number of reports which are entirely consistent with the IPCC reports in terms of the findings of the science, the implications of for the United States. It hasn't garnered a lot of attention. But the fact is that the U.S. government science community is 100% agreed with the conclusions of the international science community that this is a real problem, it is a problem that is accelerating, and it's a problem that's going to produce impacts that will have profound effects on the global economy as well as the global ecosystems. We don't really reflect as much as we should on the fact that human civilizations have developed over the last 20,000 years a period which has been associated with a generally hospitable climate. There have been some blips up and down, but fundamentally the rise of agriculture, the rise of surpluses created by agriculture, the rise of cities, the construction of cities along the seaboard, all of these things have taken place on a template of a fundamentally stable climate. Over the Earth's geological era, that is very much an anomaly. If you look at any charts, you will see that over billions of years, the Earth's climate has spiked repeatedly and dramatically. And that's caused by variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun, by variations of the Earth's tilt on its axis, and by variations in the wobble of the Earth on its axis. These things, which occur every 100,000 years or somewhat more frequently, are well known in the science, and they have created what is well known in the science of a dramatically changing climate over time. Now, there's some who have manipulatively taken that information and say, gee, the climate of the Earth has been erratic over geologic time, so climate change is natural. There's nothing new about this. Well, that's just it's either a fundamental misunderstanding or it's a fundamental misrepresentation of the implications of that. The fact is that the pace of changing the climate that is in the geologic record is one that is irrelevant to the time frame that human civilizations are looking at. It matters tremendously to the United States or to other countries if coastal sea levels rise in a space of 100 years. It doesn't quite matter as much if they rise in the space of 20,000 to 50,000 to 100 years. There are things that societies can do to accomplish to accommodate themselves relatively quickly to those kinds of things. And indeed, there's very little we can do to deal with these orbital variations and things like that. But what we will wind up being in serious trouble over is if we perturb the system so that we see changes in a matter of decades. And as I will say a little bit later, that's exactly what we're heading for. So the argument that there have been dramatic changes, variations in climate in the geological era is correct and irrelevant. We have to deal with the fact that we're making changes at a pace that is dramatically different than anything that has been seen before the humans started using fossil fuels. The next thing that has happened, in addition to the firming up of the science, is a progression of political engagement. And the politics of thinking about global warming began with state and local officials, and it has now, as I say, as I mentioned earlier, reached the federal level, where we are seeing lots of pieces of federal legislation. We are seeing active consideration of those pieces of federal legislation. We're seeing the core of Washington influence groups, which I don't know whether I want to call it a necessary evil, because evil is a bit of an overstatement, and so is necessary. But it is nonetheless a feature of the modern landscape in policymaking. And the thing that's happened is that everybody now who has an interest in this area has several people or more employed to start talking to legislators, to start getting involved in the details of actually drafting pieces of legislation. And this can make a big difference. It can make a big difference on the state and local level as well. But it's a process that's happening. The other development that is interesting, and directly related to my initial point about the fact that solving climate is a fundamental component of delivering economic security, is the engagement of major large corporations. We and several other non-governmental organizations banded together with this group of companies whose logos are on here. I think you can read most of them, but they include the three big automakers. There's still three as of this morning. But don't count on it next week. Who knows? But it involves General Electric, DuPont, Dow, Alcoa, Marsh, a number, Caterpillar, a number of major corporations, all of whom got together at the CEO level. This was an interesting part of this exercise. This was not one of these things where the vice president for public relations was told to go off and have a nice dialogue. These were the chief executive officers of these companies who got together, and they said, you know, we can't do rational business planning with this question of climate policy hanging out there in an unresolved fashion. There's essentially a disconnect between the timeline that we need in order to make rational business plans. This is particularly true in the power sector, and maybe you'll hear more about that from John, where the timeline for power planning is you want to have a power plant online 10 years from today? Well, you need to start thinking about that today. And then you want to actually get your money back on that power plant? Well, that's a proposition that stretches out to 25 years from today, or maybe longer. You need to know what the policy regime is as much as possible over that time frame. And if you have this issue of global warming policy hanging out there unresolved, sort of changing from administration to administration, or being in a state of stalemate for the last several administrations, you may be holding off the resolution of it, but you are not creating a platform for sensible business planning. That's what these companies have recognized, and that's why they are, that's why they banded together to urge Congress to enact serious mandatory global warming legislation. The next point that we are making quite aggressively is that independent analyses are showing that doing something about climate is not the drag on the economy that some have argued. To the contrary, there are lots of opportunities for producing large reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, starting first by attacking inefficiency and waste in the economy. We pay attention to what matters to us, and in the era of both low prices and no particular environmental reason to pay attention to the amount of energy we're using to produce a unit of product, the tendency is to do less of a hard look at that topic. And the result is that we have lots of opportunities in our existing system to find ways of using energy more intelligently. I like to say that, you know, our future lies in relying in the carbon between our ears rather than the carbon underneath our feet. We have lots of opportunity to use what the United States has in abundance, which is intelligence and applied to these large industrial operations to save energy. And if we do that, we can produce cost savings that ripple through the economy, and those cost savings can create opportunities that more than offset the additional costs that are associated with the fact that carbon-containing fuels will be more expensive in a society that says we need to cut our emissions of carbon. This document up here is one that was done by the global consulting firm McKinsey, which concluded that we could cut billions of tons of carbon dioxide out of the U.S. economy at no net cost to the economy, where the efficiency savings approximately offset the incremental costs of using somewhat more expensive fuels and or using some technologies to address carbon emissions. So we're now at this stage where federal legislation is going to happen, and the question is how do we design it? And in terms of the design elements, these are the core elements that we think that are going to be a central part of any piece of legislation. And here we get into a little bit of the political science component of this talk. Cap and trade essentially in its simplest form, and I am sure that in the audience here I have people who have heard so much about cap and trade that they're going to hate the prospect of hearing another 3 minutes about it, as well as some who have very little idea what it is and very little idea why they should care what it is. But let me try to walk the tightrope here and describe it. A lot of conventional pollution programs have involved taking a specific industry and establishing a specific technology-based performance standard for that industry. So we have, for example, starting in 1970, new cars were required to meet an emission tailpipe standard for hydrocarbons, for carbon monoxide, for nitrogen oxide. And it was just a performance standard expressed in grams per mile. And you have to meet the standard, and it's a yes-no decision. You meet the standard, you're legal. You don't meet the standard, you're illegal. We have the same thing, rules for power plants and other industrial sources. A cap and trade system, before moving to the contrast, that system didn't say anything about the total amount of pollution in the economy or the society. It says, For each car made, it can emit so many grams per mile traveled. But you don't know anything about the miles traveled. You don't know anything about the number of cars. So you don't have any necessary control or budget on the total amount of the pollution in the economy, even from cars. In contrast, a cap and trade system starts at the top, and it said, we want to have a national objective for how much global warming pollution should go into the atmosphere each year, and not only each year, but how much should go into the atmosphere over a period of 10, 20, 30, 40 years. The climate legislation that's on the Hill today has a budget that stretches out over through the year 2050. And that is the overall budget, something like a federal budget, if you will. Then the legislation is structured to figure out how you keep total emissions under that budget. And the basic structure is that you have to assign obligations to all the emitting categories. So you set up a budget. You say, we want to have 5 billion tons of CO2, for example. Then you say, all right, here are all the sources that are going to have to live within that 5 billion ton budget. And this, the big sources are fossil fuels, so coal use, oil use, natural gas use. and and some of the other greenhouse gas emissions that are largely associated with industrial activities. Some of you already know that agriculture can be either a source of emissions or it can be what's called a sink from emissions. And they are not, in all of the climate legislation, they are not directly regulated. So they are not sources whose activities have to fit within the budget. But there is an opportunity for agricultural activities to participate, as I'll mention. But then, so you have these five billion tons of allowances for the total system. And each ton is going to be accompanied by a certificate or a permit. So you can think of these things almost as stock certificates. And those permits have to be turned in to the government at the end of each year in an amount equal to that company's emissions. So if you're a power plant operator and you put out 10 million tons of carbon dioxide under this program, at the end of the year, you'd have to turn in 10 million permits. Well, how are you going to get those permits? Well, there are a couple of different options, and most likely, at least in the initial years, you'll see some sort of a hybrid. One could be that the government would simply auction off all these permits at the beginning of the year. It would hold a big auction, just like it holds an auction for the right to drill in offshore locations or somewhere else. And so it would auction off all these permits, and people would bid based on what they expected their emissions would be. Companies would bid based on what they expected their emissions would be over the course of the year. The other important feature is that these permits are tradable. So if you have more than you need, you can sell them to someone who has less than they need, and a brokerage industry will likely be set up to facilitate these trades, just as it has been with the sulfur dioxide. So one system at one end of the spectrum is auction off 100% of these 5 billion permits. The other, at the other end of the spectrum would be, well, we're gonna add up all the emitters that are out there, and we're gonna slice up the 5 billion ton pie, and we're gonna give the power sector X billion, and we're gonna give the oil sector, Y billion, and we're going to give the natural gas sector Z billion, and then they'll all have this amount that's given to them for free. Most of the pieces of legislation do a combination of these things. They auction off some. They provide for auctioning off some of the permits, and they provide for free allocations of some of the permits. That and both of these ratios change over time. Our view is that ultimately we want to get to a system where these permits are auctioned off, but we recognize that it's almost a certainty that in the early years that a significant fraction of these permits will be given out for free, and that you will transition over time to an auction. So that's how you set the budget, how you get the permits out into the hands of the people with the firms with compliance obligation, and then the rest of it is pretty much mechanics. You have to measure the emissions. You can't have a banking system that doesn't know what the assets are, or you can try, but as we see, it doesn't work too well. So you have to measure the emissions, and fortunately we have techniques that can be used to measure the emissions. 40% of U.S. CO2 emissions come from the power sector. We can account for every single ton of emissions from the power sector, either because we're measuring fuel and we know what the CO2 is associated with fuel, or in the case of nearly every coal plant, we actually have instruments in the smokestacks of the coal plants that report, that measure hourly what the CO2 and other emissions are, and those things get reported quarterly to the government. With gasoline, diesel, the tax system knows how many gallons of gasoline and diesel are sold and used in the economy, and we know how many emissions are associated with each gallon that's used. So we can account for these things, but so you just need a structure that requires people to do this reporting. And then there's the true-up at the end of the year, and this is just a straight transaction. The company has to report what its emissions were, and it has to turn in a number of permits that are equal to those emissions. And then finally, the flexibility. This is where some of the cost saving comes in, because we have the opportunity not only to do trading, but we also have the opportunity to borrow allowances from a future period. So if you're short in a particular year, that the price of allowances on the market is just exorbitant, so you don't want to have to go spend exorbitant amounts, you can borrow from a future year and then pay them back with interest. You can also bank. So if times are good and you've got emission reduction opportunities that are abundant, and you wind up with a surplus of allowances, you can keep those allowances and then either use them in a future year yourself or sell them into the market for someone else to use. This is a schematic, but I don't think you really need the schematic. The fundamental is that instead of having a precise uniform requirement for each and every power plant or each and every industrial source in the system, you got a budget, and essentially you use the trading and the limit on the total number of credits as the way of achieving the objective. So what about the claims of why climate change legislation is going to either wreck the economy, throw people out of work, or deprive us of necessary energy, or all three of those things? Well, and the claims have been the ones that are laid out on the slide here, that it will have an enormous impact on energy prices, which will hurt small businesses in particular, will be regressive with low income consumers, that the competition internationally will cause firms that hire people here to go overseas and will suffer job losses, and that in states like Nebraska that have a high dependence on coal for electricity, electricity prices will skyrocket. Well, the good news is that if we structure climate legislation the way that it is being designed, none of these things is going to happen. And the first things that I will just restate are these opportunities for compliance flexibility in the system. The trading opportunities allow us to if the costs of compliance at a particular plant are large, it is not a requirement of the system that they go and put controls on that power plant or that other source. They can participate in the trading market. I've already mentioned the opportunities for banking and borrowing, so let me talk a little bit about offsets, and that's one of the places where the agricultural sector comes in. Offsets are essentially getting a reduction from an activity that isn't under the budget itself. And I mentioned that agricultural activities are not under the budget. So if you can show that you are making a change in your agricultural practices that result in either a reduction in emissions or an increase in uptake, you will be able to create an offset, which is the equivalent of one of these permits that can be sold into the market. There's an opportunity for going into the international system to get emission credits there, and have, if the price for an emission credit from overseas is less than it is here, then you can go out and get that. There will be in all the legislation a regulatory oversight board that we promise is going to do a better job than the SEC. There's any glimmer of good that can come out of the financial crisis is that it has taught everybody a lesson about the importance of having effective oversight of these trading markets. And believe me, that's something that's been taken to heart by the staff and the members of the committees that are designing legislation on Capitol Hill for this problem. In terms of addressing some of these adverse issues and consumer protection, The bills typically provide for allocating allowances flowing back to households, or in the case of the power sector, flowing to the distribution companies, the electric distribution companies, and with the requirement that the consumers receive the benefit of those free allowances. Similarly, there are, in most of the bills, provisions for creating incentives for energy efficiency projects to overcome some of the barriers that are preventing those energy efficiency projects from going forward. That's and that will show up directly in the bills that consumers have to pay. You know, we pay a lot of attention to what's the price of a gallon of gasoline, what's the price of a kilowatt hour of electricity. But, you know, I think if we sit back and think about it, what we really care about is how many dollars per month we're spending on these things. And if we can get the energy services that we want with fewer kilowatt hours or with fewer gallons of gasoline, then we can wind up with a product that costs somewhat more. But if we have buildings, if we have vehicles that use the product more efficiently, our bills can be lower. I want to get to the point where I stop talking, because the question and answer session is something that I know you enjoy, and I do too. So let me just talk about a couple of other things quickly. Jobs and international competitiveness, there are design provisions in the legislation to deal with it. One is, if countries that are not adopting climate policies decide to try to take advantage and ship goods into our country, the provisions say you can't send products into our country that were produced with high polluting processes unless you have emission allowances that are sufficient to cover the CO2 that was generated when your products were made in this other country. So that's a technique to prevent countries from taking advantage of a situation where the United States embarks on this program and they do not. Second, for energy intensive industries, there are provisions in the bills that they would receive free allowances for a longer period of time in order to avoid there being any adverse competitive effect. And then finally, some serious money for worker training programs to get training done. But the even better than having to train people for new jobs is simply creating markets where people can use their existing skills to produce products that are tailored for a low-carbon economy. So if you are a builder, you can use your skills to build a low-carbon, a low-energy-consuming building. You don't need to be retrained in a different industry. Similarly, in the power sector, you can use your skills as a metal worker to build wind turbines, just as you can use them to build other forms. So, looking at Nebraska's opportunities, both crops and wind are huge resources in Nebraska, and the market for those resources will increase dramatically under a piece of climate legislation. But in addition to those resources, Nebraska, like other states, can become a home for the manufacturing of components for systems. So even if the wind turbine isn't located in Nebraska, there's an opportunity for a wind turbine manufacturing facility, or several of them, that can bring jobs to Nebraska, even if the wind turbines aren't physically located there. And this is sort of the thesis of Friedman's point, that there are huge economic opportunities. I'm going to jump through some of these things because I've already covered them in my comments. This is just an example of a recent study that shows. This was done for analyzing what would a stimulus package of taking $100 billion and spending it over 3 years in some green job areas do. And then it was broken down state by state. And the bottom line in Nebraska is that about $600 billion, $581 billion of that would come to Nebraska. It would create nearly 13,000 new jobs and have a potential of dropping the unemployment rate, which is, not too bad at the moment, but dropping it further down by more than a percentage point. So these are analyses. This was done by the University of Massachusetts based using an economic input model. This I mentioned, green jobs doesn't mean jobs that don't exist today or skills that don't exist today. We can use existing skills, existing workforce skills, but use them in these areas of building retrofitting, of mass transit, of smart grid, that's the transmission grid, wind power, solar power, advanced biofuels. So finally, these are the take-home points. We have these big overlapping challenges. We can address them together. If we fail to address them together, we're probably going to fail to solve them. Global warming seems daunting, but it's actually manageable. We can solve this problem. It provides a huge economic opportunity in the form of the green jobs. The money that we spend fighting to protect the climate won't go to Pluto. It'll stay right here on planet Earth, and if we're smart, it'll stay in America. And finally, we're starting to think very intelligently about how to design this legislation so it'll work, accomplish the objectives, and do it in a way that we all will be comfortable is sensible policy. The alternative is letting more of this happen. The Arctic ice sheet has shrunk dramatically. It is surprising scientists with how rapid this is happening. 5 years ago, they thought that the Arctic ice sheet might be the Arctic Ocean might be ice-free 100 years from now. 3 years ago, they thought it might be 40 years from now. A year ago, they thought it might be 20 years from now. And now there are scientists saying at current rates, it might be ice-free by as early as 2013. People might say, okay, that's too bad, but why do we care? Well, the Arctic ice sheet is an energy regulator for the planet. And believe it or not, crop yields in Nebraska can be influenced by whether there's ice in the Arctic or not, because the energy balance of the Earth is driven by a combination of heat-absorbing and heat-reflecting surfaces. The Arctic ice sheet is something that is like wearing a white hat on a hot summer day. It reflects a lot of energy that would otherwise have to be absorbed and accommodated in the Earth's atmosphere back out into space. When you replace that Arctic ice sheet with dark water, you have a heat-absorbing system, and you have a heat sink which traps that energy in the system. That changes currents and air patterns throughout the globe in ways that we have no idea how it will turn out. But the thing that we can learn is that we better not count on it turning out in a way that just coincidentally happens to work perfectly. We've got systems that are optimized to the climate regime that we've seen developed over the last 20,000 years, and to expect that we can just throw a wrench in there and that the resulting clash of gears will produce a result that we'll feel good about is not a smart way to proceed. Fortunately, we don't have to make that bad choice. We've got approaches now that are going to not only be good for protecting the climate, but good for addressing energy security, good for building a strong economy. And with that, I'll stop and we can have a question and answer session. Right, Ken? Thank you.
Thanks very much, David. We do have time for some questions from the audience. So please, if you would like to ask a question, go to the microphones. I think they need to be turned on. We'll have help turning them on because we are recording this, and ask your question, and then we'll have the answer. So, and identify yourself, please.
Seems like it's on. Can you hear me? Alan,
yes.
Tompkins, University of Nebraska Public Policy Center. Thanks again for coming to Nebraska. I've been told that there's a bipartisan agreement in Congress. The cap and trade is not going to be taken up in the upcoming legislative session. Now, I understand policy windows change quite rapidly, but assume that that is the case. What are the fallback policy positions in practice opportunities if cap and trade discussions don't advance in Congress?
Well, there is no such agreement, and I to the contrary, I think that you will see the administration being convinced that a cap and trade piece of legislation needs to be part of an integrated energy security and economic recovery program. So I think you're going to see that. In the absence of that, we would have to be looking at systems which are definitely suboptimal. Having something for the power sector only, having perhaps another look at the vehicle efficiency standards, all of these things are useful, but if they're done separately, we're going to wind up still leaving fundamental uncertainty in the economy about where climate policy is going next. And that's why these business leaders that I mentioned to you are saying, don't do it that way. Don't hold it off.
Hi, my name is Mary Beth Milner. I'm in the Department of Agronomy and Horticulture. Mm-hmm. Some people are suggesting that 2050 is just not a suitable goal anymore, that we've passed the tipping point, and that 2030 might have to be the reasonable scenario. So how does this legislation or the attempts at writing legislation address the final endpoint?
Yeah, a key question, and we should have started an earnest program 20 years ago, in my view. So we are slow in putting on the brakes, and I to continue with that analogy, I think we're too late to avoid the fender bender, but we are definitely not too late to avoid going into the car in front of us at 50 miles an hour. And there's a big difference between having a fender bender and hitting that car ahead of you at 50 miles an hour. And we have the opportunity to prevent that catastrophic collision. But it is going to mean that we're going to have to dig deeper, faster. That presents a challenge, because with any program, the more you do in the early years before systems are optimized and the new systems are developed, the higher the unit costs are in those early years. And that kind of is a front loading of the problem. There are opportunities with a comprehensive cap and trade program where you can use the allowance values, though, to help buy down those costs of those early, more expensive opportunities. And that's what we hope the Congress will do. Where I'm optimistic is I think that once the climate legislation is enacted, even if the caps are not set at the level where science says they have to be set if we're going to have a high probability of succeeding, that we will see market innovations occur as businesses start to seriously get engaged in finding ways to run their business and, more importantly, produce products with low carbon footprints that will open up new opportunities. And there needs to be a mechanism for revisiting the legislative schedule so that we can accelerate it, which the science will certainly say we need to do, as the costs go down of achieving those tighter targets.
Jim Frege with Genesis Renewable Energy Systems. And my question is, we're asking the developed world to reduce greenhouse gases, as we're talking about here today. What's your comment on, don't we have to have the whole world involved with this to get this job done faster?
We definitely have to have the whole world involved. And in our view, the best way to get the whole world involved quickly is to have U.S. leadership. We need to show countries that we are asking to cut emissions, that the United States regards this problem with enough seriousness that we're willing to commit ourselves to a pathway. And more importantly, we can show by success that this is something that they can sign up to. We have a model that works. You know, we did tailpipe standards in 1970. China now has tailpipe standards. We took lead out of gasoline in the 70s and 80s. China's now taken lead out of gasoline. We put scrubbers on power plants starting in the 1970s and 80s. China's now putting scrubbers on power plants. So when the United States shows that it's possible to do these things and do it in a way that doesn't harm the economy, that is, especially in the era of the Internet, a very empowering demonstration. It starts the leaders in those other countries to say, well, this is manageable, and more importantly, it has the citizenry start to ask the leadership, why aren't we doing this?
One more question. Everybody is talking about the Arctic decreasing in ice shield. What's going on with Antarctica? I haven't heard anybody talk about that.
Antarctica is a much more complicated picture. There are parts of Antarctica where there is a significant amount of ice loss. There are parts of Antarctica where precipitation patterns are causing the ice, the total mass of ice, to increase. And the short answer is nobody knows enough. What scientists are worried about is that some of the ice that is floating in the water, which historically has been the equivalent of a flying buttress in a cathedral, a brace that keeps the landed ice from moving quickly, as that starts to disappear, there are indicators that the landed ice is starting to move. And this would be a very profound problem. But the science is in its infancy. There's just not a lot of information that characterizes the rock-ice interface. And until there's data there, scientists can't even build any models to predict what might happen. So it's a big mystery, and a scary one that it's a mystery. Yes?
I'm going to ask the questions focus on the opportunities and challenges of climate change legislation, not on the mechanisms and the causes and the impacts of climate change. Yes? You were next, please.
Considering our host is a public university and a public institution that's working on the issue of climate change, could you talk about what you anticipate for public safety?
Well, all large institutions are going to have a role to play and an opportunity. And I think, you know, one of the things that an institution like the university can do is, you know, obviously make sure that its curriculum is changing so that it is offering educational opportunities for the big new moving pieces in a new economy. But there are things that can be done with respect to just the university's carbon footprint, looking at its sources of power, looking at, trying to find a way of competing for the vehicles that it uses in its fleets. Obviously, with the University of Nebraska, finding ways to engage the agriculture sector, which in the case of biofuels and biomass for energy, is an enormous opportunity. So all those things are available to the university even before legislation passes.
Two last questions.
Hi, I'm Becky Yardkamp with the Nebraska Forest Service, and my question relates to forest policy. Mm-hmm. Given that in a state like Nebraska, where we have 1.3 million acres of forest land that produce 1 million tons of biomass a year, how do you see that states like ours, who do have the potential for forest fuels as a homegrown resource, woody biomass, how do you see that playing into climate change legislation?
Well, I think that sustainable biomass from forests is going to have a market that is larger than the one that currently exists. And of course, the concern in the environmental community will be to that the issue of sustainable biomass from forests not be used as a rationale for unsustainable forestry practices and having it just become a sort of a greenwash rationale for going in and taking out forests that at least some of us think shouldn't be harvested in that fashion. So that's the challenge.
Prem Paul, Vice Chancellor for Research and Economic Development. David, excellent presentation, very good overview and also the challenges that a comment and a question. A comment is that we actually held a climate change retreat in Sand Hills last May. University faculty, U.S. Geological Survey faculty, and a number of our constituent groups were there. In the panel discussions, it was clear that not everybody's bought into that climate change is real. Mm-hmm. I must admit, even though I'm senior research officer, and I was not convinced until about last January, until I went to the national meeting, National Council of Science and Environment, the data that I saw. And I think that there is one comment is that there is a huge educational effort that we all need to support, both the formal education, developing the talent pool that who is going to work in the industries and help us fix these problems, but also a general public population with not just that, you know, believe me, but actually with the data and how individuals can relate to, you know, like one example you gave about the agriculture. So I think that that's a huge, huge problem, and building support for that. And of course, it may show my bias, but I think that there is not enough investments in research and education that we as a nation are putting forth. And this, we have to take it seriously and make it a top priority and invest resources like what we did after the Sputnik era, that we then provided global leadership.
Mm-hmm. Excellent point. I'll just say in closing that climate change as an issue is a lot more complicated than the conventional pollution problems, because there's much less of an ability for individuals to sort of ratify what they're being told by using their sensory apparatus. You know, if you go out on a street and a diesel bus comes by, you don't need to intellectualize the problem. You know, your nose tells you there's a problem, your eyes tell you there's a problem, your ears tell you there's a problem. But somebody says the climate is changing, and then they give you evidence, and if the evidence is done in a way that is typically anecdotes, it's easy to counter those with pulling other anecdotes out. You know, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. You can pull little data pieces out and make it sound like it contradicts the theory. And what is much more complicated to get across is it's the pattern of information about this, as well as the theoretical underpinnings, that has led the scientific community to be convinced that not only are the temperature changes we're seeing happening, but that they have a fingerprint, and that fingerprint is fossil fuel emissions, and we can reliably predict the direction in which things are going to go, even though we can't predict the outer boundaries of how good or how bad it could be. Not how good, just how bad or how much worse it could be. So this is the challenge, and you're absolutely correct that it would be a great thing for the university to, and it could be done, this could be done in English classes, it could be done in economics classes, where the challenge is to give the students, okay, your job is to convince someone in the elevator ride, to give them an understanding of what the basic information that's out there about climate change is. Organize your presentation, come do presentations in front of your peers in the class, and, you know, get people engaged in it. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much, and I think you can see why we were excited to be able to have David join us today. Our next speaker is local, grown from Nebraska. And we're also very excited to have John McClure, who is Vice President and General Counsel of the Nebraska Public Policy District, talk to us today about a more local level perspective about the opportunities and challenges of climate change. John has been with the Nebraska Public Power District since 1980, following his graduation from the University of Nebraska Law School. And he spent first 13 years of his career with MPPD as the general counsel's office. In 1993, John was asked by MPPD's CEO to lead the utility's strategic planning efforts. And in this position, he's held several senior management positions over the next 10 years involving industry deregulation, government affairs, corporate communications, and environmental and water issues. 2004, he was selected by NPPD's board of directors to become the general counsel. He's currently responsible for all legal, governmental, environmental, water resource, and corporate communication functions at NPPD, and most important, the strategic planning of those issues, because you've heard from David Hawkins that when you're trying to think about how to provision our state with energy supplies into the future, it's something that has a long horizon. And so you have to get the strategic planning right with regard to policies and potential policy changes in the future. So with that, John, please come talk to us today. Let's welcome him to talk to us about climate change implication for Nebraska's public electric utilities.
So we come here. What I'm going to do is do this, yeah, and then I'm going to come
in for an extra 10 minutes.
Yes, you have the same amount of time, John. And then we're here. Where is the icon for? Ah, there it is. You know, the Microsoft changes it, and then.
Okay, this is advance here.
I would use the arrows. Advances down, reverses back.
Okay. Thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here today, and from the introduction, I've had a lot of titles. I was really excited when I showed up and got my name badge. I'd been promoted to president of NPPD, but I found out from several others, including our president, that that was just a typo. You're actually going to hear some things from me today that agree with Mr. Hawkins, and you're probably going to hear several things where we have a little different perspective on what the nature of the opportunity is, and I'm sure there'll be additional opportunity for dialogue on that. I want to cover three basic areas as I go through my slides. One, I think it's important to describe a little bit about our electric industry in this state. It is unique and maybe has some characteristics that will make us somewhat different as we address this issue. Secondly, I want to spend some time providing my perspective on the challenges that we face not only in the electric industry but also in the state of Nebraska with our power industry in responding to carbon reduction. And then finally, related to that, what are the opportunities? Where are the areas that we can more readily address this than others? To begin with, Nebraska is unique, being the only state in the nation that has no investor-owned electric utilities operating in it. As a consequence, if you talk to any electric utility in the state, they will tell you their focus is the customer. What does the customer expect? And historically, what we've been told is be low cost, be reliable. In fact, that's what the state law requires. Nebraska, as a result of this, in part because of our public power structure, has been consistently among the lowest cost states in the country. And just to add a little background, for those of you familiar with the electric industry, in the 1990s, our industry went through quote unquote deregulation. And what we were told as an industry is cost is what it's all about. You need to be a low cost provider. And as was suggested by Mr. Hawkins before, we have a very long planning horizon. I'm going to talk about that. And many utilities made decisions in large part focused on how do I get the lowest cost energy for my customer. A little elevator speech on who NPPD is. Again, a lot of people not close to the industry don't really appreciate the structure of the industry in the state. We have actually about 170 different electric utilities in our state, but NPPD plays a large role. We are primarily a wholesale power supplier. We generate and transmit electricity, provide the total requirements actually of close to 400 municipalities in the state. And a large part of the eastern two-thirds of the state at the rural level receives all of its power supply. In addition, we serve 80 communities at retail. Bottom line, we provide about half the electricity that's consumed in the state of Nebraska. this pie chart gives you a little bit of comparison in terms of what is the national energy mix for electricity as far as fuel sources. About half of the electricity that's consumed in this country is produced with coal. About 20% of it today is natural gas, so there's almost 70% of all electricity produced in the nation comes from fossil fuels, and actually there's even a sliver more from oil, although it's quite small. For our system, by comparison, we are 57% coal, 24% nuclear, a small sliver gas and oil, and 1% wind at this point, and I'll talk later about where we're going with wind generation. The fact of the matter is you don't move these segments of the pie quickly, especially the bigger they are. Those large segments that you see that are coal, those are called base load. Those are generally set up to run all the time to help provide a reliable supply of electricity. This concept, I think, will make sense to Mr. Hawkins. These are all interrelated, and in his column in the World Herald yesterday, he talked about this. I really wanted to make this a Venn diagram, but I couldn't get the overlap in the center big enough, because he is absolutely right. There is an interconnection between energy policy, environmental policy, and the economy, and we can't deal with any of them separately. We have to understand what the interface is among the three major forces in our economy. I'm going to mention just very briefly, this is a draft bill that came out recently, a discussion draft. Chairman Dingell, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and subcommittee chairman Boucher from Virginia have been working very hard, and that committee has, and subcommittee. They've had a number of hearings since 2007. They've issued a number of white papers. I think they're trying to be very thoughtful on how to address this policy. Now, just yesterday, there was speculation that their leadership may not be sustained, and there could be challenges, some people with maybe some different perspectives on how to address these issues. Six principles that they have in that draft discussion draft, I think, are very important. First, emission levels and timetables should be realistic and scientifically driven. And secondly, energy efficiency and development of clean energy technologies are vital strategies for greenhouse gas reduction, and they can have economic benefits. I want to give you a little perspective. It was mentioned earlier that the electric industry produces about 40% of the CO2 in the U.S. economy. This graph just shows you what the trends have been from 1990 through 2006. The electric industry is the biggest contributor, but if you took the totals and created a pie chart, you'd see that transportation is right behind it. Industry has gone down generally because of the shrinking of the industrial sector in our economy, and you see contributions also from agriculture, commercial activities, and residential. Everybody contributes to the emission of greenhouse gases in every sector of our economy. This slide's kind of busy, but it really sets the context for the complexity, and I think it complements the comment made earlier that people are looking for some certainty. In our industry in particular, there is something unique about electricity, a number of things, but one of them is we have to produce that electricity at exactly the same time it's being consumed. There's no other industry quite like that. You can store product in other industries. You can store capacity. We can't do that today. And as I point out, there's a very limited storage capacity. Technology, as we hear at a university, the ability to store electricity is a very rich area in terms of opportunity as we go forward and look at new technologies and look at strategies to reduce our carbon footprint. It was also mentioned that we have a very long-term planning horizon. When we make a capital commitment, this is an extremely capital-intensive industry. We're making a bet for the next 30, 40, or 50 years, and we have to get it right. And so we have to know today, we have to have good enough information that what we invest in today, because our customers, all of you, are going to be paying for it for the next 30 years. That's the way we finance a project. Really, this is the big question down here, environmental uncertainty. What will be the amount and rate of carbon reduction? How will this program be structured? We need to know the answer to that in order to make certain technology decisions. If you ask any utility today in the country, what kind of generation do you want to build? There are a lot of questions. There's uncertainty, and I'll get into that a little bit more. But in the technology arena, great uncertainty about what technology do you pick. There are things off in the future that are going to make a big difference. The notion of a smart grid. Today we basically have dumb electrons, if you will. They flow on a physics basis to the point of least resistance. There are opportunities with this developing smart grid where you bring computer technology and other sophistication to make the system work more efficiently. And the potential for that, I think, is very encouraging, although we're just in the infancy. Another thing that could change this dramatically is electrification of the transportation sector. It's the second largest contributor to greenhouse gases. But how we do that, where we focus, I mean, think about it. If you electrify the transportation sector in a state that gets 90% of its electricity from coal, you may not have gained anything. But if you do that in the Pacific Northwest, where there's a lot of hydropower and no coal, you might have a net gain. So we have to be smart. I guess one point I would like to make is a one-size-fits-all policy may not work. We need to be thoughtful about regional differences in the country as we approach this big challenge. And finally, the economic piece. There's economic uncertainty globally, nationally, regionally, and at the state level. What we've found in our industry is 10 years ago, the global economy had very little impact on the electric industry. That's no longer true today. It affects the materials we use. It affects access to people. It affects the cost of fuel. So the world we live in has become much smaller in the electric industry. We believe that the long-term challenge with greenhouse gases is we have to slow the rate of growth, we have to stop the rate of growth, and have to reduce the rate of growth. You can't just go out today and turn it around. Now, you can have arguments about what's the pace, what's the timeline, and I think that's where a lot of the ultimate policy discussion will focus. Some of the challenges, and we didn't talk about this very much, there was a lot of discussion earlier about a cap-and-trade system. One of the real challenges in making cap-and-trade work, however, is today we have no commercial-scale technology available to go out and capture CO2. Unlike other emissions where you can put a scrubber on and the technology was there, you can make the decision to make that investment. You can't scrub CO2 today. Now, yes, there's technologies to do it. It's not happening on a large scale. We may hear later from one of the speakers about a project in Texas that's being pursued. And there are some demonstration projects being pursued, but we don't have anything on the scale that will be required if we're going to take 70% of the electric generation today and start addressing carbon capture and sequestration. The fact is that with today's technology, it's about a 30% energy penalty. So if you build a brand new 600 megawatt power plant, you're only going to get about 400 megawatts of electricity out of it, because 200 of it is going to be used to run the processes to capture the CO2. That's another area where technology has to get better, and it's going to take investment, research, demonstration projects, and a lot of other things to advance that technology and make it more affordable. Again, if you're in the electric business and you're trying to make a decision today, as was pointed out, it's a 10-year planning horizon. What do you build? Do you build coal? Well, nobody's getting a new coal plant permitted in the country. What about nuclear? There's talk in the country of nuclear renaissance. They're building nuclear power plants all over the world. However, nobody is really getting very far past the starting gate at this time. The discussion today is that to build an 1,100 or 1,200 megawatt nuclear plant could cost anywhere from $7 to $10 billion. And no individual company is going to take that kind of financial risk. What about natural gas? I mean, I can remember in the late 70s when natural gas was banned as a fuel for power plants. And today, it's the second largest source of fuel for electricity generation. In the state of Texas, it's 50% of their electricity generation. Gas is a great fuel. It's too bad we're using so much to produce electricity. The consequence has been the price has gone up significantly, and it's becoming a fairly, it is an expensive source of producing large amounts of electricity. Finally, energy efficiency and renewables, very important. I think everybody can agree you don't go wrong with that investment today. Unfortunately, there's a misperception that, you know, in 5 years, if we invest enough in this, we solve all the energy issues. That's just not achievable. I want to talk a little bit about how utilities plan. We do something, we just did at NPPD something called an integrated resource plan, put a lot of work into it. We started our process, we went to a group, some of you may be familiar with, the Rocky Mountain Institute. They're a little outside the traditional utility thinking world, and we appreciated their insights. They gave us some good insights as we looked at opportunities for the future. Some of the things that came out of that. For a utility, there's the generation side, that is producing the electricity, the supply side, and then there's the demand side. What can you do with energy efficiency, conservation, or demand side management? Some of the initiatives that have come out of our planning process, certainly increasing energy efficiency, conservation, and demand side management. I'll talk about that a little bit. We're adding more renewable resources, primarily wind. We are doing studies to look at much greater expansion of wind in the state. Transmission is the Achilles heel of wind development, and as I'll show you later, where we have great wind, we often have little or no transmission. We are looking at cogeneration at ethanol facilities, which can be both an economic and an environmental plus. Looking at a small upgrade at our nuclear plant, which is a non-greenhouse gas emitting facility. We are studying a pumped hydro storage project, which is a technology where you have basically two reservoirs. When energy is cheaper, you can pump the water up into the higher reservoir, release it when it's more expensive. You can also use that to firm up wind power. We are evaluating certain carbon capture technologies, primarily just watching what's happening around the country and looking at getting involved in a couple projects. We are looking at cost-effective methane projects. We helped sponsor one of the first ones put in place in the state. And then finally, engaged in research. Technology and Chancellor Paul's comment about the need for research and technology is so critical here. We are partnering with the university to help advance research in areas of energy efficiency and new technologies. We are also actively engaged in the Electric Power Research Institute. I talked about demand response, and if you talk about a smart grid, there's all kinds of opportunities to do things with how people use electricity, when they use it, to make it more affordable, to make it more efficient. NPPD has a peak load of about 2,500 megawatts. We put a system in going clear back into the 70s that we move, in large part, irrigation off of peak. If you look at that total there, that's basically a coal plant that we have avoided building because we make people not use it at certain times. We've sent a price signal so they don't use the electricity, and then we have other opportunity, find other times when we can make that up without having to build additional generation. That notion of demand side management is and demand response is very important as we go forward. Some of the things we're doing right now, we've always had a commitment to energy efficiency, but we are providing financial incentives to our customers to install high efficiency heat pumps, which can save a significant amount of energy. We are doing our second year now of a compact fluorescent lighting promotion. You know, compact fluorescent is about 23% of the energy of an incandescent bulb, so we've been promoting that. We have a refrigerator recycling program. I know it's hard to give up the beer refrigerator in the garage, but we'll buy that from you. It has to be working because those are very inefficient refrigerators. We also are about to launch a low-interest energy efficiency loan program with the Nebraska Energy Office. In addition, we have irrigation equipment efficiency testing and incentives we will pay for people to make investments to make their equipment more efficient, and finally, commercial and industrial lighting incentives. I guess the point I want to make is, and you'll see this in my last comment, there is no single solution. There is no simple solution. It takes a lot of different things in the energy efficiency arena as well as on the generation side to start reducing energy and start reducing greenhouse gases. This is a study that was put in place in 2007. This is a 2008 update from the Electric Power Research Institute. And the line you see going up is the natural growth rate from the economy of greenhouse gases. The colored segments you see are the contribution that can be used to reduce CO2 by different technologies. And the way this was put together, they looked at what the Energy Information Administration had estimated the impact of these different technologies. Then they came up with a more aggressive and said, if we could do more, you know, these are almost stretch goals, but we think they're achievable, what would the impact be? And the point is, it takes a lot of things, and these are energy efficiency, wind and central solar, nuclear power, advanced coal. But the biggest thing on here is the orange slide or segment, second from the bottom. That's CO2 capture and storage on all new coal after 2020. It takes a lot of, and again, when you hear people talking about 1990 levels, those reductions aren't getting us anywhere close, and that's out about 2030. So this is a real daunting challenge. Let's focus on the good news, the opportunities. Certainly wind, and you're going to hear more about it today, is an opportunity. The larger scale wind projects today are more cost effective. Good news is the wind is free. The wind requires no water. And the wind has no air or water emissions to be controlled, but it's intermittent. Wind facilities are subject to harsh environment, and unfortunately, good wind sites may not be where the transmission is. Interestingly, I checked to see what our wind project was doing today, and it was zero. And I thought, that's unusual. It's a very windy day. It's too windy. When you get up over 52 miles an hour, it starts shutting down. Because that is an extremely harsh environment out there that those machines operate in. And so you hope you don't have too many days like this because you have to shut down because there's too much wind. People often ask, why is it that Nebraska, which has the sixth highest potential for producing wind energy, is in fact nowhere close to being the sixth largest contribution to wind energy? Well, there are some reasons. One, several of the surrounding states have what's known as a renewable portfolio standard. We do not in Nebraska. That is a mandate that a certain percent of the energy must come from renewables. Secondly, because we have no investor-owned electric utilities in the state, we cannot get a very lucrative tax credit, production tax credit, that is $19 a megawatt hour. That tax credit can pay off somewhere close to 30% of the capital investment of a wind project. Now, we've figured out another way to get there, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Third, Nebraska, our existing generation surplus has been less expensive than adding wind. And I put up there contrast Texas. Texas moved to where 50% of its electricity was coming from natural gas. Anytime you could displace that natural gas with wind energy, you were saving money. So there was a real economic reason, notwithstanding environmental considerations, to build a lot of wind in Texas, as you know has happened. And finally, we have limited transmission in those areas of the state where we have the greatest wind potential. Here is a map of the state, and as you know, the whole Sand Hills area, where you see the red dots, this is at 70 meters, are some of the excellent wind potential areas, and there's actually quite a few in the Sand Hills. There are no people out there to speak of, and there's very little infrastructure. There is one transmission line that goes across the Sand Hills of Nebraska. Another physical problem, if you get into the panhandle, great wind sites, but unfortunately, again, not a lot of load out there, and we're delivering generation from the western part of the state east, and we're actually bringing generation from Wyoming east, and there's a real imbalance in terms of a lot of generation, not a lot of load, and there's adequate transmission to deliver the existing generation, but not for additional. And that's an issue we are looking at. We had a discussion, or there were some comments made earlier about a study from the University of Massachusetts, and I'd just like to make a few points. DOE looked at a 20% renewable standard by 2030, and for Nebraska, that would result in as much generation as we basically have today coming from wind. Not just to serve Nebraska, but the opportunity for markets. And you can see direct impacts, jobs, et cetera. I'd like to just bring a dose of reality. The study that was mentioned earlier that there'd be a $581 million investment in Nebraska, and that would produce 12,000 green jobs. I'm a little curious, and I read part of the study. If you built 300 megawatts of wind, that would cost you about $600 million. That would, if my math is correct, that would generate probably less than 100 jobs on a permanent basis. So I think there's opportunities with a green economy, but I'm skeptical of some of the numbers I've seen. I'd also like to point out, I'm from Columbus. We have 21,000 people in Columbus. This is a full-page ad in the Sunday paper. Wind tower manufacturing now expanding for 2009. We have a wind tower manufacturer in our community. They can't find people to fill the jobs. They are running full-page ads like this. So just because jobs may be created doesn't necessarily mean that people will move to Columbus or move to some other location in rural Nebraska. I think that's something that we have to think about as we talk about the opportunities here. We'd love to get them. We'd all love to add jobs in Nebraska, but just because they're created doesn't mean we have people to fill them. Part of the issue is training, and I know we're going to have someone on the panel who's going to talk about opportunities at the community college level and otherwise to help train people to work in this industry, which clearly is emerging. Here are the wind projects we've done thus far, and I indicated we own the project at Ainsworth. We've decommissioned the project at Springview, but we're going to replace it. Those turbines flat wore out. What's frustrating for us at Ainsworth, we're very proud of that facility. The first year of operation, it was a 42% capacity factor, which is unheard of for wind. Unfortunately, this year to date, I think we're around high 20s, low 30s, and it's because we've had equipment problems. We've had blade problems. We've had generator problems. We've had bearing problems, and we're working very hard to get those replaced. As I said earlier, it's a harsh environment, and we'd like to see that capacity factor get back up, and it will. We are working with private developers to build projects up in the Bloomfield area, and we are getting ready to announce in the next several weeks, maybe next week, the next round of RFPs as we add more wind to our system. We are finding, because of the production tax credit and other considerations, we're interested in partnering with the private sector to build new wind in the state. To give you some sense of scale, and it's hard to see, but there's a pickup down in the left corner. We are, That's a project going up at Bloomfield. They're 265 feet, I believe, at the hub. These are 3 megawatt machines, but it's not a simple process. You can see how big the crane is for that. When you build one of these, you have to be prepared to bring in some big equipment. When you maintain these, you have to bring in big equipment. And so scale, in terms of size of the footprint, is becoming increasingly important. This is NPPD's plan. We don't have an RPS in the state, but our plan is 10% new renewable by 2020. We've had people tell us that's way too little. We've had people tell us it's way too much, but that's where we are right now, and that could all change depending on what may come out as early as this year on climate policy. One of the last things I want to talk about is choices going forward. Now, a McKinsey report was referenced saying that we can do a lot of this at no net economic cost. Well, the average price of electricity in Nebraska today is just over 6 cents, the retail price of electricity, or $60 a megawatt hour. And that's the generation piece, the transmission piece, and the distribution piece. This is a study that was put together by some S&P authors, Standard & Poor's, and this shows you on a megawatt hour basis, and this is from last year, and you can quibble about individual numbers, they may have changed, but on a relative basis, I think it's fairly good. It shows you building new pulverized coal today could cost about 6 cents a kilowatt hour. That's what the retail price of electricity is on average in Nebraska today. And you see for $71 or 7 cents, utility scale solar at $151. This isn't the whole story. You also have to think about it if you have to deal with CO2 capture and sequestration. The cost of the coal may double. So when we say that there won't be an impact, or if someone says there won't be an impact if we start addressing climate, I think there will be. You see, all of these technologies are more expensive than, at least for our state, the embedded technologies we have today. But as you get to the right side of this, you can see that things like wind become the cheapest source of electricity, although we haven't talked about its characteristics of its intermittency. There are some days it doesn't blow at all, and there are some days it blows too much. So wind isn't the sole answer. It's an increasingly valuable piece. But if you want to rely on wind completely, the lights will be going out. So in conclusion, in a carbon-constrained world, and clearly that's what we're facing, we need significant technology advances. The things we have today are not going to solve everything to move us to a less carbon-intense future. Renewable energy and energy efficiency are a very important part of this solution, but they're not the sole solution. If we're going to add a lot of wind, if you, as our CEO says, if you like wind, you better love transmission. We will have to add significant amounts of transmission in this state and in the region. And finally, reliable, affordable baseload generation, that generation that we can count on 24/7, has to be available, and we're not sure what that answer is today. And as I've said, there is no single or simple solution. So thank you, and I hopefully have a minute for a question or two.
Well, thank you very much, John. Do we have questions from the audience? Please come down, yes. Identify yourself and ask a question.
Yep. Tyler Manquist, UBS Financial Services. I want to make a quick comment about the previous presentation since I didn't get up here in time. UBS does a lot of research from a financial perspective about climate change and some of the other things, and I was pleased to see that a lot of the conclusions were very similar, coming from a policy side and from the financial analysis. And for this presentation, my question was, if the technology does advance, I know you said that we need to have technology advances in order to do some of these things. If some of those advances happen, do you see the economics becoming much more viable? Or do you just know for now, we know we can't do it without the advances? Has NPPD done studies to look at what is possible if advances are here?
Well, I guess what I'd say is technology advances will clearly make things more viable. And there are things we can do immediately. I think as we address this, we have to look at what makes sense to do today. What things do you have to put off? It's really hard to make a decision today about baseload generation. Again, I don't think you could get a coal plant built. So one of the things we need to do if we're going to rely on coal as part of our energy mix into the future, and I think most people believe that, we need to figure out how to make carbon capture and sequestration work. And that's one of the solutions. And I think the NRDC has been supportive of getting there. But I'll let David address that. But we need to find a way to get there quickly, and we can't afford a 30% energy penalty to do that. That's going to raise the price of electricity dramatically.
Pat Hammonds from the University of Nebraska. I'm curious if
great question, and there is. We've gotten the policy ahead of, in this case, where the infrastructure is. Sometimes technology gets ahead of policy, but in the 1990s, we moved down a course to open up sales and have wholesale power be available to sell from one area to another. Unfortunately, we did not build the transmission infrastructure to accommodate that. The transmission infrastructure we have was designed for local utilities to move power from a generating plant to where the load is, and also a limited amount of interchange between other utilities for limited sales and for reliability. You know, the power system is, there's a lot of redundancy built into it, but it was not designed to move electricity on an interstate type system, and we need to move there. And it's going to take some major, massive, actually, investment to do that.
Dave Aiken, UNL. And John, I enjoyed your presentation very much, and I have two questions, and I'll ask them one at a time. The first one on carbon sequestration, if that technology becomes operational, is that just something that can be used with new facilities, or will it be something that can be retrofit to existing facilities as well?
I think people are looking at both. And again, I think you'll probably hear later, it's been demonstrated for things like enhanced oil recovery, but that's on a much smaller scale than we're talking about. And there's a lot of promising research that's been done. I just worry, having almost 30 years career in the electric industry, whether we can get this permitted as quickly and efficiently as people would like to see it done.
Thank you. And the second question is, you know, it looks like there are some things on the horizon that will help, but we're not there yet. And looking at some of the things that can help us in the short term, in some states like California, you know, utilities get credits for paying consumers to insulate their houses and to adopt other energy-saving types of things to reduce demand. Are those things that NPPD is looking at and thinks that, is that something that might be viable here in Nebraska?
Yes. To some extent, we've been a victim of our own success. We've had low-price electricity in Nebraska. And we go to businesses, as do other utilities, and make suggestions about how they could be more energy efficient. And what we've heard in the past is too long of a payback compared to other capital allocation choices that I have to improve my bottom line. But we do have incentive programs. I mentioned them earlier. And clearly, the cheapest unit of energy is the one you don't have to produce. And we have demonstrated that. So there are prudent investments to be made on the energy efficiency and energy conservation side. In a state like California, where their electricity prices are far higher than they are in Nebraska, it's been more of an inducement to invest in energy efficiency. It's made more economic sense there than it has here. But it's still good policy.
Beamer, University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Baker talked about licensing and to power sources or carbon dioxide credits and purchasing those or free trade of those or sharing of those. If it was on a market base of having to bid on those, I think a public utility state would fare in terms of being able to buy those needed to create the power, generate the power.
We'll be covered by that just like everyone else. We'll have to play in that market. And I don't think there's any doubt a cap and trade is coming. The key is it structured properly? And there are going to be dramatically different perspectives on is it free, is it an auction, how fast do you drop down what's available? Because that is what will force significant changes. As you reduce the total amount of carbon that can be released, certain technologies or certain generating facilities may no longer be viable.
Be able to be competitive in your bid?
Well, it's just like today in the electric market, we have to pay whatever the market is. If we lose a power plant, we go out in the market sets the price. Unfortunately, I think we've all learned, and especially in our industry, but also with all the people tied to agriculture, markets sometimes aren't rational. And I think there's a real fear that there could be, we've seen what speculation can do to markets and not having things built on solid fundamentals. And we need to structure whatever happens here very fundamentally sound.
Hi, my name is Eva Soule, and I work with the Nebraska League of Conservation Voters. And you talked a lot about transmission and the problem being that there is a lack of infrastructure. And so can you talk about who in Nebraska is working on that issue and, you know, who are they working with nationally to solve that?
The Nebraska Power Association is currently working on that issue, and we've been working with NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, and others, but also states around us are looking at that. There's a lot of attention right now. There's a recognition that the whole central western plains has tremendous potential for wind generation, but very limited transmission capacity, and it needs to be a regional solution.
Bobby Criswick, I'm with the Nebraska Department of Agriculture. With our strong base for livestock in the state, I'm wondering if you would elaborate a little bit on the opportunity.
Well, we have a lot of methane. The challenge is making it cost-effective to convert it to electricity. Some of you are familiar with Danny Cluthie up in Cumming County, and it's a project that several collaborated on, including NPPD. It's too expensive to invest in that for most people. It wouldn't have worked without subsidies being put into it to test the technology, but the key is, as you capture that, if you can make fertilizer, which you can, and get energy out of it, eventually, as you get the various value streams and what's happening with climate consideration, that has the potential to become viable. There are challenges sometimes in gathering and other considerations, and if you want to talk to Frank Thompson out here, he's an expert on it.
And even though we're a bit behind on our program, we are going to go forward with a break. But I'm going to ask everyone to step outside, if you wish, grab a cup of coffee or a drink, and try to come right back in so that we can start on time. We'll reconvene in about 12 minutes. Thank you very much. And the panelists, if you'd come up, we'll talk about the panel structure. In the interest of time, we have very nice detailed data and information about each of our speakers that was attached to the program. And we have, in case you didn't pick one up, they're here. If you raise your hand, we have people that can bring you one. So rather than spend the time that it would take to introduce each of our distinguished speakers and their biodata, I'm simply going to when I ask them to speak, tell you who they represent? What perspective have we asked them to address with regard to the opportunities and challenges of climate change legislation, and particularly from a Nebraska perspective? So I'm going to start following the order that's in your program. And our first speaker will give each speaker 5 minutes. We'll hold questions until the end, and then we expect a very lively discussion. We'll ask that you you challenge our panelists. Ask the tough questions. Stimulate discussion, because that's really what a public university should do. So our first speaker will be Sarah Dempsey. And Sarah is Vice President of Educational Services at Northeast Community College, and she's going to be talking to us about the education and job training perspective. Sarah.
Thank you.
You'll have to move those mics down. Yeah, there we go.
Let's try that. Can you hear me now? That sounds good. That always sounds like a commercial when I say that. Thank you. I'm just very pleased to be here, and I'm glad to represent. I actually would like to be representing the 6 community colleges that Nebraska has in our state. And when I was asked to be a part of this panel, I thought it was a very interesting topic, and climate change legislation actually has quite a number of implications for training and education throughout the state. It's not only in the community college purview, though. The educational needs for the kinds of renewable fuels and renewable energy training opportunities and maybe emerging industries really needs to reach down into the K-12 systems, onto the community colleges, and onto the universities. And I can tell you a little bit about, there are a number of people in the room who've been working with me over the last 2 years. When Northeast Community College received a $2 million community-based jobs training grant to fund a statewide ethanol production training program. We did that because this emerging industry had very few opportunities inside the state of Nebraska to train incumbent workers or to prepare new workers to enter the pipeline and sustain that growing and increasingly critical to our economy's ethanol industry. We did what I'd like to think is a good job of bringing the industry representatives together. It was actually a wonderful job. It's been a great experience for me personally. And almost all of the sitting CEOs of ethanol plants in Nebraska sat down with us and others on the ethanol board and other related constituencies, and we developed a curriculum that we were able to put in place in 2 very short years across the state of Nebraska, the only part of Nebraska that does not have some type of credentialed ethanol training program right now is in the western part of the state, and they are very close to getting theirs done. When we started the project, western Nebraska didn't even think they would have an ethanol plant, and there was one across the border in Colorado, and now there is one there. There are 24, I think Todd Sneller and I were speaking this morning, I believe there are 24 operating plants now in Nebraska, and it is a very competitive industry and very costly. So to be able to reduce the cost of sending their employees out for training, and that would be new employees who are staffing up for bringing those plants online, and they would also be incumbent workers for continued training to allow people to progress through various types of responsibilities at these plants. I think we've added a great deal to their bottom line by being able to keep those individuals close to home, provide a consistent, approved, the curriculum has been fully endorsed by the ethanol board, and allow a cheap way, a very cost-effective way of providing the necessary training for keeping this industry going. The difficulty, of course, is that it's not the only renewable energy around. And I think Nebraska is very fortunate to be in the position that it's in to have such a bright future in wind energy in particular. Others have spoken about that today. Biodiesel is a fuel that's on the horizon, and I feel certain that Nebraska will become engaged, more engaged than it is today, in biodiesel as we get down the road. Cellulosic types of raw materials for producing fuels, all of those things are possible, I think, in the state. And it's important that we have an educational infrastructure that's able to deliver the kinds of training that's needed when it's needed. When we also add to the fact that those technologies change by the minute practically, and the great news is that they're improving all the time, and plants are already retrofitting and wondering about how they might adjust to using new types of materials to produce fuel. But we do need to be ready for that, and I am very proud of the way higher education is very much in many ways similar to private industry in the sense that while we may be viewed as one big happy family, we often are not. And so there's a fair amount of competition out there, and there's a fair amount of competition for students and resources and facilities and faculty and all of those things. They're very difficult to get, especially for an industry like the ethanol industry that's highly specialized and very expensive to get off the ground. I am very pleased, though, to tell you that we have formed a strong consortium, and it does move from a first course in an introduction to ethanol production in the high schools that will be launched this fall. Just had a conversation this morning, wonderful conversation with Kathy Lang at the Department of Labor about the potential of putting together some type of pilot that might where we might be able to deliver that course in particular to high school students across the state. At community college rates, and by the time those students would graduate from high school, all Nebraska community colleges would have the ethanol production degree program in place and be able to move on from there. Nice, seamless transition. And then Ann Seltzer and others, Ken and others here at the university, have been very strong collaborative partners in working with us to articulate a two-year degree onto the university system. That is, if you don't live in our world, it may be difficult to understand what a coup that really is. That's a tremendous effort on people's part, a tremendous leap of faith that we're all working from the same page, that we all have the same desire, and that we all want to see the same outcomes for the state in particular. So I'm very proud of that. I'm very grateful to the expertise that's lent by the university and by the great collaboration. By next year, we'll have an articulated degree, and we're very, very proud of that. I think the challenges continue to be the same things they are in many ways in other industries. The technology changes. The technology is expensive. This morning, or just this past week, I signed off on a little over $250,000 worth of equipment for my program alone at Northeast alone, and there are six other community colleges. Now, we've worked really hard not to have to duplicate that equipment. That was the point of the partnership. So we have not duplicated all of that equipment across the state, but in some cases you must have certain foundational equipment to be able to make a program run. But it works. We're happy about it, and we look forward to meeting some of the challenges ahead of us.
Thanks very much, Sarah. And we'll let's hold the applause because we're going to treat the panel as a panel in common. Otherwise, we won't get through it. So we're now going to ask David Ditloff to speak, and he'll be representing NGO environmental advocacy groups. In particular, he's with the National Wildlife Foundation. And again, you have more detailed bio data in your program. David, I believe you have some slides.
Well, let's go. I think she started without it. Let's wing her here, and then for the sake of time here,
okay.
I'll wing her here. You look at the challenges that climate change presents from an environmental standpoint, and specifically we focus on wildlife at the National Wildlife Federation. There's really two sides to this equation. The first one, really deals with cutting our emissions, so we avoid these catastrophic effects that Dave talked about with the IPCC report. And that's critical, and I think that's what the bulk of the conversation will be on here today. And partly because David gave such a good program already here, I think I might shift over to what we figure is the second real important factor here in challenge involved with climate change, and what would need to be a component of climate change legislation. And that gets to the idea that once again David talked about that. Carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for a long time. Most of the greenhouse gases do. We are likely, because of that, going to be seeing some changes. I would argue that we're already seeing some changes to our climate. If you look around in Nebraska here, I'll talk just really briefly here about some of the potential effects here, because I think we need to put them out a little bit here in order to talk about how we craft legislation, but. just in Nebraska specifically, you know, most projections, and this is going to oversimplify things a little bit. This is a whole hour-long presentation in itself, but you reduce water flows in the rivers and streams. You're talking about, you know, Missouri River, the Platte, and even some of the smaller streams, but particularly those that flow out of the mountains where there's expected to be less snowpack. And the kind of the wildlife repercussions associated with that are obvious. You know, think of the Platte River and the controversy, the cranes. And the cranes don't create the controversy, but the water controversies, revolving around it. You look at habitat shifts northward. Most folks, experts project that as the temperatures increase, probably there'll be migrations northward of certain species. Somebody said that there has been armadillo seen in Nebraska here in the last year. That didn't happen 20, 30 years ago. You think of armadillos, you think of Texas and Oklahoma. Just that being one example. Wetlands, particularly in the western part of the state, likely to see fewer of them, have them dry up earlier than what they do now. And then, particularly into Nebraska here, the trout fisheries, the cold water fisheries, that exist mostly in the western part of the state once again. Those are really, trout are a cold water species, and as temperatures rise and stream temperatures rise, they'll cause problems and could potentially, many of those populations be extirpated. So looking at climate change legislation, what do we do about this? As David and his program has showed here, there's you have the allowances, and there'll be auctioning or selling off of the allowances to pollute that would be given to industry. I think from an environmental NGO standpoint, we're looking to see that some of those allowances be auctioned. There's a big debate right now between 100% and zero, and I think probably legislation is going to fall somewhere in the middle. I think from an environmental NGO standpoint, the higher the better, I think, in our standpoints. But some of the funding that would be created from that auctioning system, if it's created that way, could be directed towards conservation projects, on the ground, habitat and restoration projects that would mitigate some of the effects that we are already seeing in certain places and are likely to see in the future. And how it's distributed, the recent bill that was heard on the Senate floor, divvied that money up in a number of ways. 35% of it would have gone back, to the state agencies. 10% would have gone to the Army Corps of Engineers to do water projects, 5% to the Forest Service. So basically spreading around to a lot of the land and wildlife management agencies that would affect species on the ground. That bill over its 30-year lifespan would have dedicated $7.2 billion to those restoration projects. And the way we see it is here, it's not necessarily to pad conservation here. Any money we can direct towards conservation, I think, in our minds is generally a good thing. But because we're seeing these effects caused by the changing climate, that it's appropriate that some of the monies be directed to prevent species extirpations, to make sure that some of the natural systems that we rely on, wetlands protection and the flood protection that entails, agriculture, if you're looking at keeping water conservation efforts, that be a part of any national climate change legislation to a certain standpoint. Obviously, that entails a cap-and-trade system. I think a good portion of what I would label the environmental NGO community is pretty close to where I think David Hawkins has said, pretty supportive of a cap-and-trade system. There's specifics here and there that obviously would create debate, but that kind of gets to the emission side of stuff. But we need to make sure as we proceed forward that we have some to help kind of the wildlife in these natural systems adapt and survive as we go into the future. The last thing I guess I'd like to say, and I don't know how we incorporate this into national climate change legislation. In some ways it's more appropriate for state regulation and and maybe with federal, where there's federal lands, federal land management. But how we proceed with all these good things in the pie, and I completely agree with John that there's no one silver bullet. We're going to have to jump into a lot of things, and I think the full NGO community is supportive of wind power, solar, even carbon capture in storage, I think. How we proceed with that, I think, can be really important to our natural systems and protecting the environment. John's program talked about the pipeline infrastructure that would be needed for for carbon capture and storage. How those pipelines are managed and the environmental regulations involved with them would really be important. The siting of wind tower facilities, so they're not in key migration routes, would be another bit. So that's a key thing that I think we're going to need to keep an eye on, because sometimes what's good for reducing emissions wouldn't necessarily be that great for our natural systems and our wildlife. So just another thing I think that needs to be pointed out as a topic.
Great. Thank you very much, David. We're now going to move to a perspective from the biofuel industry. And we've asked Jim Jenkins, who is chair of the Nebraska Ethanol Board, to present that perspective. Jim?
Okay, thank you, Ken, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you to the University of Nebraska. This is a debate that and discussion that we need to have over and over again. The reason I'm involved in ethanol and also in wind energy is because I live out in one of those unpopulated areas that was referred to earlier, Callaway, Nebraska. Don't have a lot of climate problems out there except in the year 2002 when the grasshoppers ate more than my cows did. But from my perspective as a rancher and a business person, we as a state need to be very tuned to finding out how we can play a central role in the ag, energy, and environment intersect. And I think while it's controversial and there's going to be debates and discussion, we need to really get on with it and use forums like this to start to develop a strategy. First, I want to talk about ethanol and what it's doing here in the state. Most people don't realize this, but ethanol, actually, we're producing now 1.3 million or billion gallons of ethanol in a state that consumes roughly 900 million gallons of transportation fuel. As we all know, the transportation fuel is the Achilles heel of our energy challenge here in the United States. We only produce about a third, now I think even less than a third, of our own transportation fuel here in this country. One out of every 7 barrels of oil is consumed on American highways. There is a huge impact from a national security, from an environmental, and from an economic standpoint. The great thing about it is Nebraska is right at the center of the biofuel and alternative energy revolution. We, through 30 years of effort and bipartisan support, have come up with one of the best and largest biofuel economies in the world. We have a $3 to $4 billion biofuel economy. To put that in perspective, agriculture, which is the number one industry by far in the state, if you look at the number one industry within agriculture, it's cattle, roughly, depending on how you count it, $7 billion. Corn probably now with the corn prices up, $4 to $5 billion. So ethanol now is probably in the number three position, and that's all happened literally in about a 5 or 6 year time frame. So what are some of the opportunities? Well, my concern is that as we look forward, many people seem to want to run on by ethanol. There's a lot of criticism. I hope you bring some of it up. I'd like to have more than 5 minutes to discuss it, so I hope some questions challenge why we should have ethanol and the good in ethanol. But the fact of the matter is ethanol has saved this country or the citizens of this country about 30 to 40 cents a gallon over the last year or so and replaced 7 to 8% of the total market share of oil. Now, to put that in perspective, up until 4 or 5 years ago, there was no other alternative replacing oil. Oil was the only game in town. It's a problem here in the United States because we only have 2.5 to 3% of the reserves. The other problem is that the rest of the world, places in the Middle East, can produce oil for about 50% of what we can produce it for. So if you really are a free enterprise person, we should buy all of our oil from the Middle East. But for national security and a whole bunch of other reasons, I think it's important that we diversify our energy portfolio. So what can we do here in Nebraska? Well, we have done the hard work. We've got 1.3 billion gallons of ethanol. We're only using 850 million gallons. Or 900, depending on where the economy goes. We have done the hard work. We've got the raw material. And by the way, the energy balance, if you look at 9 out of 12 of the reports, the energy balance is positive in ethanol. One of the things we have to do is get the science right on ethanol. I don't have time to go into it now, but the fact is that with the new plants and, more importantly, the new technologies being used out on the farm, GPS, no-till, and better irrigation techniques, we are seeing a dramatic improvement in the carbon footprint of ethanol, and I think that needs to be documented. I know Ken and his team at the University of Nebraska are working on that. But we have an opportunity in this state to become almost completely self-sufficient and wean ourselves off that oil dependency if we can figure out better ways to distribute ethanol and send gas stations and consumers to utilize ethanol here in the state of Nebraska. We have a group now that is testing stationary alcohol power plants for irrigation. There's all sorts of opportunities that I think we can tap into for becoming energy independent here in Nebraska. And that's a vision that we couldn't have talked about 4 or 5 years ago. The final point I will make, and that is comes to what the challenge is. The challenge really in terms of climate change legislation has to do with how are the policymakers going to define the footprint of ethanol. That can be a big negative here in the state of Nebraska if somehow or other the definition includes indirect land use down in South America. And so my greatest fear as a citizen and a proponent of ethanol is that we're going to have very we could end up regulating ethanol to such a point that we actually retard its progress and undermine it. And I think it's important for everybody to understand that ethanol right now is the only significant challenge to the oil and carbon fuel economy that we're trying to address. And we cannot just let it fall by the wayside. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jim. And I appreciate staying on time. Jim gets so excited sometimes about his topic that it's like a runaway freight train. But our next speaker will address the perspective of the wind power industry. And we're going to ask Cliff Messner from he's the Economic Development Director in Central City, Nebraska. And Cliff has some slides for us. Boy, it gets hard to, I think you're...
This one right here, maybe?
This one right there. And then we come down here to there. There we go, Cliff, and you can use the arrows.
Thank you. I'll jump right into it. My topic is wind. Challenges for wind, there are many. I want to talk about three. The first one is the concept of balancing the load. One of the issues that's out there is that there has to, as John pointed out, the generation must constantly match the demand. That's difficult enough when we're constantly changing the demand by turning off our light switches or turning down our air conditioners or whatever we do. But when the load is constantly changing on the other end because the wind is constantly changing, it doubles up the problem that the power companies have to deal with. That, unfortunately, falls directly to the power company, and it's a technically difficult thing, and it creates an awful lot of grief for them. One of the other problems that's there that I don't think John really went into is that they have to build capacity for 100% of the demand load, which means that they have to go out and build a coal-fired plant to cover whatever electricity we might want to use. If the wind is blowing, they can close that thing down, and they can quit burning coal in it, but they still had to build it. And they have this very expensive capital expenditure out there that's now underutilized, so that's helping drive up the price of electricity all the time. It's a major issue for them. Those are complicated by the fact that we have no real storage system right now for electricity. If you had a storage system, the balancing of the load problem wouldn't be so difficult. You take advantage of it when it's blowing, you store it when you don't need it, and you don't have to build something to match the load 100% of your firm capacity. Some things that are possibles out there are elevated storage, which John talked about, battery technology, not in the sense that you're going to have a big battery sitting out underneath the wind turbines, but if you talk about electrification of our transportation system, you have batteries that are being used at times when your electric demand is down, which makes the system much more effective to use, and hydrogen, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Next big challenge is transmission. I used to think the transmission was a big problem because it was a big cost. And then I found out how much it costs to save an investment bank on Wall Street, and it doesn't seem like such a big deal anymore. The issue becomes who's going to pay for it, and how does MPPD, sitting in the middle of Nebraska, make that system work for them when there is a huge cost to put that transmission in to be able to transmit it to where there is a need. And I think the concept behind cap and trade legislation is that it forces us to go to the places that it's most cost effective. And if it becomes cost effective for somebody in Chicago to build wind towers in Nebraska and ship them out, a good cap and trade system should help pay for that so that MPPD is not saddled with trying to build that system. Key opportunities. Wind is a pure source. That's not true of everything. It's not true of biofuels, and it's not true of hydrogen. And that gives us a real advantage, I think, in the wind side. This is a slide that I stole from Sandy Thompson with it from H2Gen, and it's got a lot of numbers on there that I'm not going to go through, but I want you to look at the main concept here. This first column over here in red shows the carbon footprint of gasoline. The next column over shows using hydrogen for transportation, and as you can see, it has a bigger carbon footprint than gasoline. That's because we produce most of our carbon or most of our hydrogen by burning coal and throwing a lot of carbon into the air. If you go over to the fifth column, which is way down, it shows what happens when you get your hydrogen out of ethanol and biomass ethanol. And if you look clear over on the sixth column, that little sliver that's there, that's what hydrogen costs you when you, in terms of carbon footprint, when you get your hydrogen from wind. So one of the advantages, and if you go through the best model on the biofuel side, you'll see that reducing the carbon input of electricity helps you out a great deal with the carbon input on your biofuels, on ethanol. So creating wind electricity helps out in a lot of different directions, and it improves the technology that we have every place else. So I see wind as being kind of central in that respect to a lot of the other technologies that we want to pull together in order to show a reduction in the carbon footprint. Other advantages that we have is that our electric rates are very stable as compared to natural gas and oil costs. They're very, very stable. We can get a 20-year purchase power agreement on the wind side. You can't come close to anything like that on the oil side. What do we in Nebraska need to do? We need to prepare to ship out of state. We have an abundance of a valuable, clean, renewable natural resource. It simply does not make sense for us to keep that in the state when there's a need for it outside the state. I was out in Sydney yesterday. The city administrator was crying that their property tax rates were too high in Sydney, and across the border, we were looking at it literally as we stood, was a $1 billion wind farm. And they wanted to build that in Nebraska, but they couldn't build it over here because we had some paper barriers that were in the way. We've got to tear those down. We've got to start taking advantage of this being here. There's no reason for us not to be exporting this valuable resource. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cliff, and their very, very lucid presentation. We'll now ask John Bourne, who will present a perspective of labor advocacy groups. John is the international representative from the 11th District for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. John.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We'll talk a little bit about challenges that we see and then go into some opportunities, and I really think we could title it, to me, it's all about the jobs. The electrical industry as well as the IBEW faces many challenges as well as a huge amount of opportunities, and whatever the possible outcome of the possible legislation that's going to be developed is, not only in Washington but in right down the street here in Lincoln as well. Maybe first I better explain a little bit about the IBEW. We're an international union of 770,000 men and women that are working in industries that can and will be affected by climate change legislation. Our people work directly for the power companies that will probably be the most affected by what changes come about. We also represent workers in the manufacturing industry, which hopefully will build the new and different products that eventually will help our climate as we go through this. We are also the construction workers that build and maintain current generation facilities for various utilities, as well as all the other types of commercial and residential facilities as well. The most common way of training for my part of the industry has been apprentice and journeyman training through our apprenticeship training programs. We have 300 programs in cities throughout the U.S. and Canada, and that's true for most of the other trades as well, plumbers, fitters, boilermakers, welders, that type of stuff. Most of these programs are funded through hours worked by all the workers, in other words, private dollars. In fact, everything we do is tied to the hour of work, training, health care, pensions, etc. So all the dollars for training are watched over very carefully, and hard decisions are made by our training people and made what to train for. So this gets us into what some of our challenges are going forward. I think from my perspective, our energy policy in the United States has basically been a series of rapid move-its from one crisis to the next. In reality, we haven't been solving a lot. In one of the commercials shown this year for one of the presidential candidates, it started out with Nixon on the screen and went through each and every president talking about dependence on foreign oil and how they were going to solve the problem. This, of course, was some weeks back. Before oil came down to what it is today, as I filled up my car coming down, it was $2.02 a gallon. I thought, wow, that's pretty cheap, you know, compared to what it's been here not too long ago. Today we're not thinking about that it's too bad, at least until the next crisis comes around, and of course it will come around. This is a challenge. The challenge in this is having the political will to change, not just our legislators, but all of us as well. It doesn't appear to me that we have any long-term planning and working on a national energy plan, and I think that's going to be the biggest challenge we face long-term. We're building wind towers all over in Iowa, but by the end of each year, we race to get them done so they qualify for tax credits allotted to them. We're not against tax credits, but to double and triple the crews to hurry to finish them by December 31st is not a very efficient way to construct anything. And matter of fact, to us workers, it's dangerous. The same can be said for training in the construction area. Without a long-term plan, how do we make plans for how to train our workers? What do we get them ready for? Wind, solar, biodiesel? In Omaha, there was a building just recently constructed that was to have a huge solar array on it. We sent people off to learn how to teach a course in solar, and so they'd come back and teach others how to do it, a train-the-trainer type of course. We started to get our supplies together and be able to have enough people trained and be ready to do this job. After we got some of our people trained, they dropped the solar off the building. We spent a lot of very valuable dollars that could be spent elsewhere on something that's not ready really to go yet. We need a long-term plan, and then the construction industry can hopefully meet the challenge of training. Another challenge is right now construction is ranked very low in the minds of a lot of people entering the workforce in different employment fields. Every parent wants their child to be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, maybe the president of the country, whatever. There's a mindset that construction is low paid and not very skilled. There's also a perception that you don't always work. There's continual layoffs, and it's hard to make a living. It's outside, it's cold, it's wet, it's hot, and it's dirty. And while some of this is true, most of it is not. The construction field today is different from what our fathers and our grandfathers did, and there's many chances to move up the career ladder if you would so desire. While like every job, there is some good and some bad, there's certainly some good in working in our industry. Matter of fact, a heck of a lot of good. I'm the third generation in it. Right now, before the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, there's 21 different companies that are talking about building 34 nuclear plants in the United States. And as we talked before, huge amount of dollars. And I don't really think that anyone expects them to build that many, but if they really did, build that number of facilities. Without a workforce that we are already thinking is going to be hard to find people for, what are we going to do? I am told in the utility world that in the next 10 to 15 years, we will lose more than 60% of workers due to retirements. I happen to know it's very close to the same in the railroad world. If we are truly going to move climate change into the forefront, we had better make sure there'll be enough trained people to build what we will need for the future. We need not just import workers from someplace else, but we should be training local people for these jobs. The last challenge is large. Washington is talking about forcing change on a lot of segments of our economy. Some of this is going to be good. There's no doubt about that. Some of it I think we'd better look at very hard and take it a little slow and use some good old common sense. If the wind industry could be developed to its full potential, we've all heard today, and I don't think anybody will argue that it's going to be good, it will require a $1 trillion investment into transmission of it. $1 trillion. Who will pay for that? Right to our remarks just a second ago. Who's going to pay for it? If we're really going to push the generation industry into nuclear power, whose backyard will we put the waste dump in? How do we rebuild the electrical infrastructure of the country to handle all the new mandates? Where will the money come? And really, who wants a transmission tower in their backyard? Not only that, but who will build the transmission segment of the industry when we are already very, very short of line technicians? While some of these are challenges I see from my group, there's so many opportunities I think I could go on all day. The economy of this country runs off people working. A shift in energy policy and climate change legislation could have such a positive effect on the economy, it could be fantastic. Could green jobs be a way to give people that don't have opportunities or didn't have opportunities before a hand up instead of a handout? I think it should. Can we make our world and the country a better place to live and maybe a little more environmentally friendly? Undoubtedly. Can we, working with our legislatures, push new ideas, new strategy, new inventions? And there is absolutely no doubt that the United States can do that. But we must use our common sense, make some long-term plans, make sure we see the big picture, and not just to rush change for change's sake. Let us look at not only what we are doing for the future, but how does it affect some of us all today or no matter what industry. By changing the rules, we could destroy one industry while we're trying to build another one up. In the end, that won't help. Remember that eventually we will all pay for this change in one way or another. In Nebraska, we've got it pretty good. We have a very low cost of electricity. We have great power districts that work hard and work hard every day to make sure we have the power we need and when we need it, which isn't as easy as most people think. Every change in the law in Washington and in Lincoln will affect each one of us sitting in the room. Some could be good changes and some can be bad for Nebraskans. There are reasons that companies want to move to the Midwest, and I, for one, want to build more of those facilities and all of our families get more opportunities for employment or maybe to sell the goods of the companies we work for to the people moving here. It appears we're looking at some very real opportunities in Congress to do the right thing, and I hope we all work together and make sure it is the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Our next speaker will talk to us with the perspective of the construction industry, buildings, architecture, and energy efficiency. And we're pleased to have Tim Hemseth, an assistant professor in the College of Architecture here at the University of Nebraska. Tim, I know you have some slides. Which one was it? Pardon me? Ah.
Let me get the lights.
No. There we go. Okay, and... Gee, many crickets. This thing is so hard.
I'll take care of it.
You can.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ken. So, as Ken mentioned, I'm at the College of Architecture. I'm also chair of the Nebraska Flatwater Chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. I just wanted to ask a question to start off with. Who here in the room lives in a house? How many of you work in an office that's in a building somewhere? All right. Well, it's good. It's good in this economy to see that we're not all homeless and unemployed. When Ken asked, you know, what are the key challenges and opportunities that result from the passage of climate change legislation for the building industry, I think we can all see that building efficiency has a direct and immediate impact on all of us. And the speakers today have highlighted various priorities and the importance of building efficiency. What I want to get across is that we have the technology today We have the knowledge and the ability to directly impact our energy consumption tomorrow. And many of the politicians in this political debate have been talking about drilling for more oil, drilling for more energy. And the comprehensive energy plans proposed, centered on these facts, would do little to remedy the situation and would supply just 1.8% of the total U.S. energy needs, which is a drop in the bucket. And until we resolve this issue, we have no choice but to rely primarily on coal energy, as we saw from John's presentation, as our primary source for energy, which is what contributes the most to greenhouse gas emissions. With rapidly accelerating climate change, which is now fueling dangerous regional and global environmental events, data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration illustrates that buildings are responsible for almost half, or 48%, of greenhouse gas emissions annually. It is imperative to address the impacts of buildings holistically. Current electricity usage includes operations of the various buildings that make up our cities, towns, and urban areas across Nebraska. Given that our buildings have a lifespan of 50 to 100 years, and many will outlive all of us, we need immediate action to reduce electricity consumption. Buildings are, in this slide, contributed 39% of CO2 emissions, but they can also be 39% of the solution. 76% of all electricity generated by U.S. power plants goes to supply the building sector. Therefore, immediate action in the building sector is essential if we are to avoid hazardous climate change. As we renovate, retrofit, and build new, we need real strategies to impact electricity consumption. From the current 300 billion square foot of existing building stock nationally, we will renovate over 150 billion of it, remodel another 150 billion by 2035. As we go about this massive overhaul of our building stock, we need to build better buildings, we need to build smarter buildings, and we need to build buildings that have zero net energy and energy efficient strategies. However, nationwide, there is opportunity in the fact that there is a lack of research data on green building performance. There's a lack of education, as John's mentioned, on how to manage, operate, and inhabit green buildings, as well as a lack of capacity in the building trades to meet this demand. We must look at the large scale. Cities, utilities, and industry-wide changes are needed of the building stock, as well as retrofit standards for everyone in each of our homes and our places of business. Energy efficiency standards and policies are critical measures that we need to use to reduce carbon emissions and use as a benchmark. We have current standards and policies in place that can be used immediately, but are largely underutilized, especially some of that in Nebraska. We all live and work in buildings and spend 90% of our time indoors. Climate legislation will require us to reevaluate our built environment and how we live. Currently, 44 states, out of the six remaining, Nebraska is not one of them, 107 cities, none of which are in Nebraska, have taken important and critical steps to address the built environment. Of this list here, which is publicly available on the U.S. Green Building Council, there's one institution of higher education that is listed here, which is Metro Community College in Omaha, that have taken measures. Individual LEED certified green buildings, for example, can on average save 352 metric tons of CO2 emissions annually. If we each take immediate and measurable steps, we can have a direct impact on our energy consumption. That's it. Thank you. I'll make up some time for you.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for you. So not now, but later. So we'll get to you. Our last speaker, before we hope to have a vigorous question and answer session, is Greg Kunkel. And Greg is going to represent the broad business community, the entrepreneurial spirit of our country, and how it might adapt and respond to the challenge of climate change. legislation. And Greg he's vice president of environmental affairs for Tenasca. And do you know? I think. Is that yours? No. Let me see. There it is, right there. And once we get it up there, where's the? There we go. There you go. And
just use the arrows.
And use the arrows up and down.
There wasn't much on that slide anyway. I can't see it. Can you see that? Or is this? Or, no, this didn't really work. No.
We can change the background on it.
No, that's all right. I just need to go up.
Well,
and
you're like
it's not going up for me.
Let's see what we can do here. These arrows right here.
Yeah.
There you go. Down is forward.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I had a couple of stray thoughts listening to all this wonderful discussion. This is a very democratic subject because it affects everybody. Everybody uses fossil fuels, and so everybody's fuel costs will go up. And everybody uses electricity. You know, so it's very democratic. And kind of a neat thing about it, if you look at that McKinsey report that David mentioned, that if there's a there's kind of a list of all the supply of emission reductions of things you could do and how much they cost, and like about half of them that we need to contemplate are actually have negative costs. In other words, you do things that save electricity, and they're mostly building things. You know, all the early ones that you would, you know, sensibly do first are the ones that save you money, right? And there's a whole bunch of them that, you know, like save you $90 a ton of CO2 that you've emitted, you know? So I got to jump on that, you know, and it's mostly stuff that anybody can do. So, you know, I started to do this at my house, the little curlicue light bulbs and stuff. I mean, it just, you know, a lot of that stuff is very sensible. And we've been blessed by really high energy prices in the last year or two, and they're kind of gone down now. But that's kind of gotten everybody thinking about this a little bit. You know, you go, well, gee, I can actually see a benefit there on my bill at the end of the month if I use less electricity. And you know, I mean, it's helping. You know, we may not like OPEC, but they make us think about what they're doing to us, and we need to be thinking about this sort of thing. A while ago, a year and a half ago or so, people in my company, Tenasca, started to get very concerned seeing climate change legislation coming. And they said, well, we can either sit on our hands and do nothing and see what the government requires of us when it happens, or we could kind of get up off our butts and think about this, analyze what the impacts are on us, and see what the opportunities are going to be, because there's going to be a lot of change that happens when this happens. So we started doing that, and we just assigned three people with nothing better to do, and I was one of them. And it's been a lot of fun to look at, and we started looking at little ideas, and we kind of gradually migrated to big ideas. But one of the early things we looked at is, well, what is the impact on a company that builds, owns, and operates power plants, which is kind of our main line of business. We have about 10 million tons of emissions of carbon dioxide per year, which is similar to you, I think, round numbers. And so if carbon costs us $50 a ton times 10 million, that's a big number. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, small by Wall Street standards, but you know, for me, that's a big number, you know. And it's a big number. I mean, it's, you know, in a coal-based economy, I mean, it's like doubling your electricity bill here in Nebraska. So this is the first thing that everybody sees. You go, whoa, you know, I don't want my electricity bill to double. That would be pretty darn unpleasant. But believe me, you know, we would really start looking at these things we can do to our building and our lights and our refrigerators and our appliances to reduce their energy use. And we can do those things. And I mean, the thing is, that technology is there and it could be deployed fairly quickly, and we've just got to get the manufacturers of equipment and refrigerators and so on going, and they're ready for us, you know. But we have to create, that's what this thing really does, is it creates a market for reduction of emissions. And we would jump on it because nobody likes to see their bill doubled. But that's a very big number. I mean, something like $1 billion a year for going into bills, electricity bills in Nebraska would be non-trivial. There'd be other offsetting benefits. The value of wind generation would double. Because for every megawatt of wind you produce, you'd be offsetting a full ton of coal emissions. Well, that makes wind generation in Nebraska much more valuable than wind generation in Texas, where you're only displacing natural gas generation. So we might have, you know, more of a moneymaker here in wind than some other parts of the country. Anyway, what I wanted to miss a little bit of stuff about Nebraska. We used to be a small Nebraska company. Now we're a big company. We're like the 25th largest company and privately held company in the United States. And this happens to be a Nebraska company that invents power plants and goes out and builds them and puts them under long-term contracts and operates them for long periods of time. And now we're thinking about, you know, what kind of power plant is needed for this new economy we're contemplating. And we've got a couple projects I can just quickly talk about. One of them, and these are kind of two technologies that use coal. I mean, we essentially already have a fleet of natural gas-fired power plants that Tenaska built that is the most efficient, the lowest carbon emissions of any fleet in the world, and all invented in a little shop in Omaha. And so most people wouldn't know that. But if you look at NRDC's website that benchmarks the various utility performance around the world, Tenaska's the lowest carbon emissions for all the fossil fuel fleet of the largest generators in the country. And why? Well, we build big, natural gas-fired, efficient combined cycle units. And it really shows what you can get. You can get to like 860 pounds per megawatt hour using those efficient, state-of-the-art, large central generating stations. And that's about a little over a third of the less efficient established fleet of coal-fired units across the Midwest. So that we can do with natural gas, but natural gas is a really expensive fuel. And recently it's had tremendous volatility, and which has really frightened a lot of people. And so it's clear that even though natural gas is a pretty good answer and gets us down the road a long ways, it may not be the ultimate answer. And in any case, it has costs. And those are very volatile costs, which is troublesome. So we're looking at solid fuel projects now that would address this carbon problem head on. We decided that we won't try to develop any coal-based plants that do not address this problem head on. We're looking at two technologies. I mean, it was said, and it's commonly said, this can't be done. So I should just sit down and shut up. But we're trying anyway, and we figure if we don't try, then we'll never figure out how to do it. So we've got a project which is an integrated gasification combined cycle project in Illinois, and we're learning how to do that. And it basically is a technology in which you gasify coal with oxygen and water under high pressure and temperature, and you create a synthetic gas of hydrogen and carbon monoxide. And then once you've created that gas, you can make a whole range of products with it, including power, methane, ammonia, and methanol, a whole variety of other products with it. In this plant, what we're going to do is we're going to make basically natural gas. We're going to take coal and convert it to natural gas. We're going to burn pipeline quality natural gas in the power island of this plant. And we'll accomplish in this plant, in the gasification island, well, it can accomplish about a 50 to 60% capture of the potential carbon dioxide emissions from the coal that goes into the gasifier. So that's kind of that technology and what it can do. And we're working with the state of Illinois to build the first such plant. The other project that we're working on is one in Sweetwater, Texas, which is basically more of a conventional pulverized coal boiler plant. And The idea of having it there was that it's near markets for carbon dioxide, which is the greenhouse gas that arises from burning fossil fuel. And the market for that is enhanced oil recovery. What the oil industry in Texas has learned to do is to use carbon dioxide under high pressure as a solvent for extracting oil from the pore spaces of rock underneath of the ground and to get oil out of the ground that they couldn't otherwise obtain. This is called tertiary recovery of oil. And the limit of that has really been CO2 supply around the country. There's various geologic limits of it, but we could produce, some estimates indicate, 1 billion barrels of additional oil supply in North America through enhanced oil recovery. What we see is that we're going to need to do a lot of this CO2 recovery, but these early projects need some economic basis. I mean, nobody is paying us today to not emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but here's a market that we saw that would pay us today for that carbon dioxide that we capture from the flue gas of a conventional pulverized coal plant. So that's the idea of that project. And those are just a couple ideas we're working on. We're working on wind, we're working on solar, we're working on a bunch of other stuff. And this is going to be a lot of fun working on this whole carbon thing. There's all kinds of regulations that are going every which way, and it'll matter hugely how they all turn out. And you know, it's going to be very complicated and very exhausting, but lots of fun to work on. So I hope you all just get into it. One of the things that would be really neat would be if somebody here in the economic department or something would create like a financial model of Nebraska that would allow policymakers here to evaluate what the impacts of this proposed legislation are on the economy of Nebraska. And it would be good to know, to have an answer to, you know, what's the impact of, oh, let's say, a $400 million price increase on electricity. You know, it'd be nice.
Thanks very much, Greg. We'll have a chance to thank the panel again, but Greg, you'd be happy to know that when I look out at the audience, I see at least 2 top flight economists that heard your message. So let's open it up to the floor. I'm hoping that you will challenge our panel, that we'll get into a very constructive, lively debate, because I think everyone here in their presentations indicated this is extremely exciting time to be alive, to be active in commerce and industry and education, and it's in challenging ourselves to see clearly the path forward that will come out of this as winners in a rapidly changing world. So let's start with questions first, and identify yourself, please.
Yes,
sir.
Gary Thompson. I'm on the NPPD board. And I'm not going to challenge the panel, but I did have a question for Mr. Messner. The last bullet that you had on your slide, and you didn't get to, unfortunately, dealt with conflicts in the credits being in conflict with seabed. And I just did not understand what that was about. I'd like some clarification on that,
sure,
if I may. Thank you.
There's a problem with the use of the production tax credits. And it really centers around who can use them because they're passive tax credits, which means that the only people that can use them are people who have passive income and don't have alternative minimum tax. Now, they're alternative minimum tax free for 4 years, but they're not after that. So what happens with them is that you really end up with these tax credits being used by large corporations, because large corporations aren't subject to the same alternative minimum tax problems, and they're not subject to the passive loss rules. So consequently, you have to find large corporations to come in and use these tax credits now, and our seabed legislation makes it harder to bring those same people in to use it. So you have kind of a natural conflict between the seabed legislation and the other legislation. It's really not our seabed legislation that needs to be changed, it's the federal legislation. We need to open this thing up so that middle-class Americans can invest in it. We do a lot of tax credit projects on the housing side, and right now it's very difficult to find investors who want to buy the credits. It would be best if the federal legislation was changed, but if it's not, we need to change our seabed legislation to match up with it.
Very good. Yes. Next.
Rick Perrin from the Ag Economics Department. Is this on?
Yes. Yeah.
Also for Cliff, you've answered part of my question. I was just wondering, I mean, anybody looks around the states around us and we see a lot less wind farms in Nebraska. And I was just wondering, and you had mentioned changes of the law were some needed regulations and laws are there in Nebraska.
Well, of course, one of the reasons that we're behind the other states right now is because we've been ahead of the other states on the cost of electricity for so long. And our costs have been down, so it hasn't been as effective to build wind generation here as it's been elsewhere. But there are some restrictions, and John's the one who should really be answering this, in terms of how we're shipping electricity out. And it's my understanding that we haven't shipped electricity out because we've been a public power state, and by shipping electricity out and competing with people who are not public power, we ruin the market for everybody else. But now what's happened is we've had a paradigm shift. You have federally subsidized wind farms all the way around Nebraska, and we're not competing with those, and we're not taking advantage of the federal credits here because we haven't been able to build it and ship it to the places that it needs to go.
Good. Thank you very much. Please.
My name is Jay Liu. I'm from the National Drought Mitigation Center. I'm a hydrologist, so I'm interested in the relationship between the water and the energy. So it seems to me the biofuel is a promising solution to secure the regional economies, especially in the state of Nebraska. But the corn-based biofuel production is still controversial because many people thinking corn-based biofuel is threatening the food security and the sustainability of water resources. Recently, I had a chance to read an article, and the article said to produce 1 gallon of biofuel, the 3,500 gallons of water is required, which is a huge amount of water. So in the state of Nebraska, if you're looking at it, there are many water issues going on, including groundwater pumping moratorium and interstate river compact between the Kansas and Colorado and Nebraska. So it's a very hard to miss out this water budget for sustainable biofuel production. So this situation could be worse in case in a severe drought. So my question goes to the Jim Jenkins. So I'm just I'd like to hear about your vision to deal with this water issue for the sustainable biofuel production in this context.
Well, one of the things that's happened is that with the finally, when we get out of the $2 corn rut subsidized by the American taxpayer to the tune of about $20 billion, not all of that, of course, goes to corn, but a substantial amount. Now that we're out of the $2 corn rut, we've actually seen out in Custer County, where I am, and all the counties around me, a tremendous surge in irrigation technology. We've got a neighbor of mine who is putting in underground T-tape or drip irrigation and saving somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% to 40% on the water. So that now we've finally got out of the $2 corn rut and we've got the threat of $4 gas prices. I think you're going to see, and believe me, I don't think this is an easy answer. You know, it's every single one of these options that we talk about have problems, whether it be wind and its intermittency, or ethanol, or oil, or coal. One of my big pet peeves is the news media likes to talk about each one sort of in a silo, and they'll go complain about ethanol, but they won't really look across all of the different problems and challenges associated with all the energy. To answer your question, I guess I'm optimistic, being at the grassroots level, that we're going to see and are seeing right now a tremendous decline in water usage to raise corn. Now, clearly, corn cannot on its own be able to carry us forward and solve all of the energy problems. It's only meant to be one tool. The other thing I would say to you, in the case of a drought, the legislation that we have right now in place, which has a 15 billion gallon cap, actually that 15 billion gallon cap we're going to reach, what, in 2010, there are off-ramps. So if we do hit a drought situation, government policymakers can elect to actually lower the production or lower the amount of mandated ethanol going into the system. But I admit to you, this is one of the challenges we have. We have to make this sustainable, and we're going to know more about ethanol over the next 2 or 3 or 4 years as we get into a more mature industry.
Just to clarify numbers, though, because numbers are very important here. The 5,000 gallon per gallon number you cite is for all water, whether it be rainfall, residual soil moisture, or irrigation, all together in one sum. But the real factor here is how much irrigation water is used to produce a gallon of corn ethanol. And that value is more because a bushel of corn takes about 1,800 gallons of water. You get 3 gallons of ethanol per bushel of corn. So the number's more like 600 gallons of irrigation water per gallon of ethanol. And that's not much different than the water requirement of gasoline, by the way. So
thanks again for your help.
Next.
Frank Thompson with Nebraska Public Power District. I'm going to pick on Jim again. My question, Jim, goes to, I guess we see a transition to the plug-in electric hybrids. It's something that I believe will certainly expand rapidly. But can I go buy a flex fuel plug-in electric hybrid vehicle would be the question. I don't even think I can buy a hybrid now that's flex fuel. So I would like to know what the ethanol board is looking at as far as making automobiles produced overseas as well as in this, any automobile sold in this country be a flex fuel vehicle.
Well, we're certainly advocating a much higher use of flex fuel vehicles. The great thing about it is there are 1 million on the road already. It's unlike T. Boone Pickens program, which requires a tremendous change in infrastructure for compressed natural gas, we already are able to deliver fuel to Nebraska consumers in flex fuel vehicles. The technologies are all there. I think for an extra $100, you can have a flex fuel vehicle. Now, when I say that, you can't go out and add that onto it, but the fact is that's about the additional cost to put that flex fuel component into your vehicle. We would advocate that if we're going to look at the plug-in, and I'm a big proponent of plug-ins, I think it's I've got a plug-in vehicle on my ranch right now. I drive up to my garage in a golf cart on steroids. It's got big tires on it. I plug it in, and I use it to salt and mineral my cattle, to do fence work. I've already taken a step to try to get away from the fossil fuel economy. What we would promote from an ethanol board standpoint is let's make sure that those hybrid vehicles, those plug-in vehicles that rely some on gas and some on electricity, are designed to use biofuels.